You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, good morning. I'm Daryl West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation here at the Brookings Institution. And I'd like to welcome you to our fifth annual John Hazen White Manufacturing Forum. And we are webcasting this event live, so we'd like to welcome our viewers from around the country and around the world. We will be archiving the video from this conference, so people who want to view that afterwards will have an opportunity to do so at the brookings.edu website. We also have set up a Twitter feed at #USMFG. That's #USMFG. So if you wish to post any comments or ask questions during the forum, you're welcome to do so. And it's always interesting to go back later and kind of compare the conversation we had within the room with the virtual conversation that is taking place around us. So we have several distinguished guests with us. Our benefactor, John Hazen Wright, is to my right. So he is here along with his wife, Liz, and sons, John and Ben, who are over here. So please join me in expressing our appreciation for their financial support of this forum. So thank you. So for several years, we have explored different aspects of manufacturing. We've looked at the manufacturing renaissance in the United States and what has helped to bring the sector back. We've studied the obstacles facing the industry and ways to overcome them. One year, we examined the Obama administration's initiatives on regional manufacturing hubs and what they are doing to encourage innovation. And last year, we focused on workforce development as it related to manufacturing. With the many interesting developments that are taking place around the world, this year we chose to focus on manufacturing in a global context. What are other countries doing? What innovations in leadership or workforce development have been successful? What lessons can the United States take from what other countries are doing? So today we have a program that will look at several aspects of global manufacturing. Our first panel will examine the role of leadership, and we have people from the private sector as well as the public sector to offer alternative perspectives on this. And then after that, we will have panels that look at innovations in workforce development and lessons from abroad. And we'll hear from people in China, South Korea, and Australia. We have someone from a German company on this panel, so we're trying to incorporate a variety of different angles on this. So to help us think about this topic, we have several prominent experts. Eric Lachambre is the Chief Operating Officer of Velo, one of the leading manufacturing firms in Germany. Eric has been a member of that company's executive board since 2011. He's responsible for operations in mature markets, division circulators, group marketing, and group service, among other activities. John Hazen White is the CEO of Taco Comfort Systems in Cranston, Rhode Island. He is the third generation of his family to head Taco, which was founded in 1920. So soon you will be coming up on your centennial. In recent years, he has innovated.
Not me.
The company. The company. I was not implying that you were about to hit 100, although you would be a very youthful-looking 100 if you were in that category. In recent years, he has innovated by hiring a new president and chief operating officer, Will Vanderweel, who is actually here with us today. The company has acquired Hydroflow Pumps, a Tennessee manufacturer of pumps for mining and agriculture. And most recently, the company acquired an Italian pump maker, Askel C. Jennifer McNally is the executive director of the Manufacturing Institute, which is the nonprofit arm of the National Association of Manufacturers. In that position, she works on the attraction, qualification, and development of world-class manufacturing talent. Her goals are to support research on manufacturing excellence, focusing on innovation and talent recruitment, and then solutions that will help make American manufacturing more competitive globally. Jay Shambaugh is a member of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. In that position, He advises President Obama on a range of issues, including manufacturing policy. He is on leave from George Washington University, where he is a professor of economics and international affairs. So, Eric, I'd like to start with you. You are the COO of a very successful German manufacturing firm. And, of course, Germany is considered one of the world leaders in manufacturing. So what is Germany doing right in manufacturing, and what should Americans know about German manufacturing? And I ask that even though you're French.
Yeah, but that's I was about to start with this little detail, actually. So, in fact, I'm French. I'm working for a German company for 7 years. And I had the chance during my life to work in different countries. So I spent time in China, 4 years, but also in Canada, in Belgium, in Austria, in Italy. Living and working in those countries gave me the chance and the opportunity to see differences. What I can tell you definitely is that describing in a few words why Germany is successful in manufacturing is a bit of a challenge. But I try to make it simple, because that's also one thing I learned in the U.S. We like simple things, at least to make complex things simple. And I try to summarize in 4 points, actually. So, successful manufacturing in Germany is due to the fact, point one, that it's a nationwide cause. It's a nationwide mission, manufacturing. Everyone works in the same direction to support manufacturing, because everyone knows how important it is for a country. Government, politician, association, workers, shareholder, and so on. So that's point number one. This is important. Point number two, which is also very important, is the structure of the companies. Small and medium enterprise are very strong. In Germany, they are also called Mittelstand companies. You have a lot of them successfully, and their success is coming from the fact that they are family-owned. You know what it is. Family-owned company focusing on niche market, and being most of the time number one, two, or three in their niche, actually. Why are they so successful? It's because it's family-driven. Family are investing in the future. This is very important. Now, they are also supported, and this is the third point, by a very interesting institute called Fraunhofer Institute, which is supporting those Mittelstand company with innovation. Innovation in product, in processes, in way of doing, and this is something very important. We can talk about it for hours, but make it short to start. So what to summarize this Fraunhofer Institute, what it does that those small companies are not home alone, actually. They have someone to help. And point number four, last but not least, workforce. The educational program in Germany is particularly well done for manufacturing. I don't say it's the best overall for all type of job, probably, but at least for manufacturing, it helps a lot. This dual training, dual program, whether they are vocational, so like type of apprenticeship, or study, because this happens also for university, learning on the job, and especially for manufacturing, you need people who are convinced that they are going to do a job that they would like, that it's not only being working in a noisy, dirty factory, but in a place where they can really do something and contribute. So I believe, in a nutshell, those 4 points are really summarizing for me the reason why Germany is doing such a nice job and being able to keep a level of around 24-25% of the total GDP coming from manufacturing sector. And this is really a success, because if you look at the evolution of the last 30 years, they were at 23, 30 years ago. They are now at 24. And when you look at all the other countries, developed countries, whether it's the USA, UK, France, they were at certain time at the same level, but today they are around 10-12%. So, of course, this means a lot of potential. But let's say at least this is a summary of the situation in a nutshell.
Well, that's impressive, 25% of GDP. That is a country that is taking manufacturing very seriously. So, Johnny, you have worked in American manufacturing for a long time. What is America doing well, and what does America need to do better?
You know, this. I think we had a lot of red wine last night, right? Did we talk about this? Because it's like one of the same sheet of music, absolutely. I think a lot of what Eric has talked about is relevant here. I look at the U.S. as a huge opportunity, obviously, to recreate manufacturing. I think where we may have fallen behind as much as anything is the image of manufacturing, and you've just talked about that. I think manufacturing has taken a role in this country of being something less than where people want their children to go. And I think if we can somehow find a way to overcome that over time, I think we'll position ourselves. We talked about this, I think, last year. There's a small town someplace because we're all confronted with regulatory issues and all this, a lot of the same things wherever we are. And we're confronted with material costs. Right. This is the one thing I've learned is we must purchase worldwide low material costs because the rest is up to us. Right. We control the productivity and the labor content and everything else. So I think in so doing, we've created these factories which are incredibly efficient, incredibly high tech. And there's a small town, we talked about this last year, somewhere in the Midwest that has a factory which is one of the largest suppliers to the automotive industry, I think. And they're losing more jobs in this company due to retirement and whatever than they have people to fill. Okay, so the company was facing closing and moving and going bankrupt. And what they did was they came together with the town to put together a program, the city to put together a program to bring kids in from school because parents were not allowing their kids to go to work in the factory. And so they were bringing in the kids first, and the kids were going home and saying, I got to work there because it's pretty cool. It's like a video game. And the parents were saying, no, it can't be. And so then the town was bringing the kid and the parents in. And then they were paying the kid $80,000 a year after high school to come to work. I'm not sure where I go with that one mentally because I think kids ought to be able to go to college too if they can, but they were immediately paying them $80,000, and that town has resurrected its manufacturing base. And so I think that proves the point that if we can all collectively get a vision of what manufacturing really is, not the dirty old place that you have to go just to earn a living, it's something that, and college education and manufacturing are not exclusive anymore. I think they go together. So I think if we can overcome some of the imagery, we can move ahead pretty rapidly in this country.
Okay, Jennifer, you are working on making U.S. manufacturing more competitive globally. So could you tell us a little bit about your activities and what you would like to see the United States do?
Term of service with the World Economic Forum, where I chaired the Future of Manufacturing Global Agenda Council. And we examined actually this exact topic. What is going on in the global marketplace with manufacturing? And what does it take to be successful, whether you're a developed nation or a developing nation and everywhere in between? And the architecture, we actually just released the report this past week, and it's up on the World Economic Forum website if anybody's interested. But we actually looked at sort of a new social compact with manufacturing as it relates to the role of the public sector, the private sector, and ultimately civil society. And what does it mean from a jobs perspective? And what does it mean from a policy perspective? And what does it mean from a growth perspective? And what we did through sort of 2 years worth of work and benchmarking, and I think we ended up with 22 or 23 case studies that looked at the drivers, is fundamentally we are at the precipice of significant change in manufacturing. And that creates a new set of opportunity. It's not just the product innovation, it's the process innovation that's driven by new technologies and the efficiencies that drives in manufacturing. And then what I always consider my sweet spot, the people innovation. and what that means for job creation and opportunity. And in the context of that, we benchmarked against the role of each of those constituencies and agreed that what we really need is greater transparency. What does manufacturing look like in a growing economy or a developed economy when communities come together at really the job level to do exactly what we're talking about here, to create opportunity? And what does it mean when you have the ability to manufacture in environments because process has changed so much, sort of the democratization of manufacturing in growing economies and the new market opportunities that that brings forward? So as I think about what that means for the U.S. here, and, you know, the Institute spends half of its time benchmarking both globally, what I know is the people element is a number one C-suite issue. That in the end, having individuals understand what modern manufacturing looks like, what the career opportunities are, is really important here in the United States. We do have a culture of college for all, yet I think there's an increasing sentiment here in the United States of what is the value cost of that opportunity. I would say juxtapose that against the apprenticeship model you spoke to of both going on in Germany that we benchmark constantly against, where individuals have the opportunity to advance in an education environment aligned with what their economic opportunities actually are and what their interests are. So college and lifelong learning becomes an element to that. So as I think about what we need to be doing here in the United States for the competitiveness of manufacturing, not only do we need to change the perception of manufacturing? And we've started to make great strides through activities like National Manufacturing Day, where we're asking our nation's manufacturers to open up their doors and invite in parents and teachers and counselors and students so we can firsthand show them how exciting it is. I think we also need a new conversation about what the public education system looks like aligned to what the nation's economic opportunities are. And those are the kinds of things that we look at the Institute. How can we create good public policy to advance the competitiveness of manufacturing?
Okay, thank you. So, Jay, speaking of government, you are on the front lines of government through the Council of Economic Advisors. What is the public sector doing, and what should the public sector be doing to enable manufacturing?
I think there are a lot of things that have already been raised. And so I think, on the one hand, there are issues in workforce training where I think some of the programs trying to engage more with the community college system to try, you know, different countries have different institutions, so we wouldn't follow exactly Germany's apprenticeship model, but there are a lot of things you can do with things that are unique to the U.S. system, like the community colleges, to try to map people better to employment opportunities. I think the National Network of Manufacturing Innovation is a really important development that's taken place more recently that I know you've covered in previous years, where we're now up to, I believe, 9 institutes across the country, and we're building towards 15, where we can really try to do more to make sure that we are keeping the U.S. manufacturing firms at the cutting edge, where we're linking them to the places where R&D is happening to make sure that R&D turns into actual manufacturing process. But I think one other thing, just because it hasn't really been mentioned yet, is we've talked about both sourcing globally or being globally competitive. There's also the issue just that manufacturing is an export-oriented industry within the United States. So the U.S. is a huge economy, so we can do a lot of trade with ourselves, but manufacturing is a little different relative to a lot of other industries in the United States in that a much larger share of what's manufactured here is exported. And so I think one of the things that is really important, and we've tried to take really seriously over the last 7 years or 7.5, is defending U.S. firms in global commerce, right? And I think it becomes a really important issue in what we often refer to as trade enforcement. And this can be in two directions, right? On the one hand, it's because so much of manufactured content is exported, a really important thing is to make sure that exporters are getting a fair deal abroad, right? To make sure that the trade deals that you've negotiated are actually being implemented in the right way. And if you can go back and look, I think in this administration, we filed 21 cases at the WTO, which is more than anyone else in that time. And we've won every case that's been adjudicated. And I think the reason is that broadly the U.S. follows its trade rules that it's supposed to. And one of the important things is just to make sure other countries are doing the same. And that's not a knock on any other country. not long after the U.S. and the EU had more trade going back and forth, they filed a lot of cases back and forth against each other, just trying to make sure that we were all doing what we thought we should. And as other countries kind of join the global trading regime, it just requires the same activity of pointing out, you know, that rule of yours isn't actually consistent with what you've agreed. So a lot of this has been Department of Commerce making sure that that Korea is implementing the Korea Free Trade Agreement properly, such that U.S. firms have the chance to hit that market the way they're supposed to be able to, whether it's making sure other countries aren't using dumping or countervailing duties in an inappropriate way that are blocking U.S. firms. And I think it's something like 200 cases where U.S. exporters have come to the government and said, we have a problem here. We can't get into this market. That over the last few years, we've been able to go around and get other countries to change those policies. And in every case, it's not earth-shattering. You say, oh, it's $5 million more of exports to that country, or it's $10 million there. Those things aren't going to change the entire world, but they're really important to the individual firms and to their success. And they also set precedents to try to make it easier for other firms. And then just lastly, I'd say, one of the issues we do face globally in manufacturing right now is that in some core industries, there is some clear evidence of overcapacity in things like steel, where one of the issues you run into as an economist, you want to think, well, these things will sort themselves out. If there's overcapacity, prices will move, firms will change. But if you've got a very large share of production taking place in a country that's not really responding to market forces, that requires more engagement by the government. It requires both using your own trade rules to block dumped or subsidized products, but also it really requires more than just tariffs. It requires true global engagement. And I think that's where we've seen a lot of activity in the last year, especially with meetings through the OECD or through G20 and G7, are trying to get everyone together to say, look, where there's a problem, we need to come together globally and try to sort this out, because we need to make sure the global market economy is working in a sensible way.
Okay. I'd like to throw out a question for everybody on the panel and give each of you a chance to answer. And there are a couple of variations on it. Kind of, what lessons should the United States learn from other countries? And are there particular countries that are doing this well? Some of their activities may be unique to that country, but are there things we can learn? And Eric, maybe we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, as I said, the German model is very specific. I believe it cannot be copied in a way, but pieces could be used as example. And as you said, we cannot copy the apprenticeship model, but we can learn from it. Mm-hmm. What works there? Why? I believe this is one of the most important elements for the future, because manufacturing is going to face a new challenge. And there again, Germany is setting an example in being prepared, and our company also, of course. But this is what we call the revolution, the fourth industrial revolution. This is something which is going to be bigger than what we expect. This is the smart factory. This is the future. And this is a huge weapon for mature market, mature country, to be able to compete in the new global situation. Germany was for the last 20 years providing machine tools, processes to the worldwide industry to grow. How Germany is going to face the future that everyone is able to produce. Quality is improving everywhere. Growing countries are now even innovative in product, in processes. So the way to succeed is to be always ahead. Being ahead, this is again relating to the nationwide mission I was mentioning before. Germany decided 5 years ago that to pass this fourth industrial revolution, they need to put everyone in the same direction. And there is this huge project also helping those small companies to be prepared to the future. And back to the challenge of the workforce, you don't need now just people who know how to work in a factory. You need those people, but they need to be digitally prepared. And I tell you, it's going to be a new challenge. And if we are not prepared for that today, we will not be ready tomorrow. And this is exactly what was started. And when we talk about Industry 4.0, and you know about that because at the last Hannover Messe, USA was the guest country. And there were a lot of discussion around that. And I can tell you that this is one thing which is very important. And this is one thing I believe the US could learn. Development of the workforce for the future, not only for today, and finding a way to face the challenge of the future for manufacturing in general.
Johnny, what lessons do you think the United States should learn from other countries?
Well, I'm going to piggyback right on what Eric just said, because I think we have a lot of common thoughts in our everyday lives. I will tell you this. As I look back at the development of Taco, we have had to stay in the front technologically for the purposes of productivity, quality, and marketing. So the lesson I've learned from folks like you is that investment is continually the forefront of what we think about. We've invested in machinery. We've invested in productivity. We've invested in quality. These things have saved the company and, in fact, provided a platform for it to grow and develop. But I will tell you this. The single most important investment that I think any of us can make is in our workforce, in our people. And I look at this from different perspectives. Of course. Now, in my company, 500, 600, 700, 800 people now, with a turnover rate of under 0.5%. So we retain people. That's a good thing because we are able to protect quality and all of those things. But we also now have a workforce who's committed to succeeding. They're not thinking about the next job. They're thinking about succeeding at Taco, both with them and their families and their community and for the company. It's the greatest single investment we can make. Plus, I also view us as companies. This isn't really answering your question, is it?
But it's a good answer, so that's okay.
I know it's a good answer. That's why I'm giving it. I view companies like ours, manufacturing companies, as communities with people that have real lives. They are not there to provide me a good income. I'm there to provide them an opportunity to live a better life, to grow and prosper with their families. That comes back more than any other investment we can make.
Okay.
That's my answer to your other question.
Okay, no, that's fine. Jennifer, what lessons do you see?
So I'm gonna share a story. When I started my service as the chair of the Future Manufacturing Committee, I had the opportunity to visit a aviation composite company in the UAE. This is about 2.5, 3 years ago. And when I think about sort of the growth of manufacturing, there is sort of this pattern that is historical, and I'll note, and the new rules do not apply in today's marketplace. And that was, you sort of started here at the low skills, rules-based, and grew your manufacturing economy as you became more sophisticated with the processes, and you entered new markets, and you moved up the value chain. And 2.5 years ago, I had the opportunity to tour Strada in the UAE. And they entered at the top of the value chain in aviation, so one of the highest contributing manufacturing sectors, at the top of that value chain within 5 years, are now a tier one supplier to our nation's airplane builders. 5 years. That's what manufacturing looks like today. And the other unique element associated with Strada, and part of why I was invited to visit it, was 80% of their domestic workforce was female. And it was built at the community level around family contributions and wanting to contribute to the growth of the community that they lived in. And it was 120 women that had all been through very structured training programs. And 2 years later, and 20 of them are team leads. So they're seeing a career pathway It's built at the community level. It's around that schedule. And again, at the top of the value chain, they're going to compete in the global marketplace. And that's the way we need to be looking at what manufacturing is. These are not just incremental steps we need to be thinking about. It's sort of the Uberization of what manufacturing is going to look like. Where are the disruptions from technology, from the fourth industrial revolution, that are going to rock the foundation and reinvent that opportunity? And I think that can be really scary, or that can be really, really exciting, the innovations. And that's the way we need to be looking at the horizon in a global marketplace. It's a very different horizon, and we need to adjust to that.
Okay, I want to get Jay's perspective, then we'll open the floor to any questions from the audience.
So I'd say some of the things that are lessons that we've already been trying to learn, as I mentioned, the manufacturing institutes and things like that, where we literally did just go around the world and see what other countries were doing that we weren't and tried to take those lessons home, or whether it's trying to work more with the community colleges in an apprenticeship-like way. But I do think there's one thing that if you look, and it's not just manufacturing, it's a bit broader than that, but it really, I think, relates to manufacturing in the United States, is different from many other advanced economies, is we lose more prime-age people out of the labor force than other countries do. And when shocks hit, and shocks will hit for a whole variety of reasons. They can be trade shocks. They can be technology shocks. It could be that a firm in a given town just didn't innovate. It didn't take the steps John's talking about, and it lost out in competition. We don't catch those workers well enough. They fall out of the labor force too easily. And you look at our prime age in particular, because you can strip out kind of the cultural differences, prime age male labor force participation in the United States is on a 50-year trend where it's been declining. This is not a new thing. But you look at it compared to other countries, and it's moving in a different way. And we're losing people, and when we hear over and over, you hear people talk about firms that are worried about do they have the right workers and do they have the human capital they're going to need, is that I think one of the things other countries do better is when a shock hits, retrain. When a shock hits, do lifelong learning. When a shock hits, support workers so that we don't lose them out of the labor force. They're back in a different career and a different job faster. And I think whether it is bulking up community colleges, doing free community colleges so people later in life can get back into them, whether it's wage insurance so people will hop back into a job quicker and not get disconnected, reforming unemployment insurance, a whole bunch of steps we can take, I think would be crucial to trying to make sure that the labor force people up here are talking about is there when they need it.
Okay. Let's open the floor to questions from the audience right here. And if you can give us your name and organization.
My name is Andrea Pesoris, and I'm with PLLC from New York. Perhaps in order to influence agency, you know, management, because they are such an important factor here, if that's the theme of the panel, we need to revisit policy that comes at the level of the president and the White House. So perhaps we need to revisit repealing the G8 agreement that George H.W. Bush went into while he was president. So with the Germans, he agreed to deindustrialize America, go into no net new job growth. And the Germans in time were able to cover for their reunification costs and have access to an EU free trade zone where the national champions could export into that without tariffs and things like that on the euro in time. So shouldn't we look at policy, what's going to, and we need to stop planned obsolescence. And we're not just doing that in our manufacturing as a management profit strategy, you know, and it's kind of a pathetic, insipid profit strategy. The Germans aren't doing that. Don't we need to have the right respect at the level of where policy can influence agency decisions, and management has to be properly incentivized and not just with the ability to, while deindustrializing, they aren't having a heavy balance sheet anymore. They run all kinds of saves and costs through the income statement to play income statement games, and so they make themselves look like they're more profitable. But we've been self-immolating for the last since George H.W. Bush's G8 agreement. And you see it in the rise in the equity markets. Management's just been able to plow the money back into the turn of the paper rather than putting it back into our production footprint. And many of the producers are government contractors. So what's remaining of America's industrial footprint are government contractors in one way or another. So we've shrunk 15% of our GDP from production down to only being 9% of our employment workforce. And whereas it's not quite an exact correlation with regard to when you're looking at a data analysis, don't we need to reflect on the things that so we don't need to do trade liberalization, we don't need to do, and we need to stop doing free trade agreements? Don't we need to reflect on these? I'm not agreeing with Donald Trump, but don't we need to?
Okay, I think we have the question. Yeah. Jay, you want to respond?
Sure. I guess the first thing I would say is just there is no plan to deindustrialize the United States at the government level. Like, that is not the goal. I think I can say that in the economic sphere, there is almost no issue that animates this current president more than the notion that we can make things in the United States. Whether it's having like a Maker's Fair, whether it's having these national manufacturing institutes, there is a strong belief that we can make things. I also, though, do think it's important, and this goes a little bit to something John said earlier, we are good at manufacturing, right? I mean, I think one gets this idea that because other sectors have grown faster, well, we just can't make anything. And I will say, as an academic, I get frustrated when I hear other academics say, well, of course, we just don't make things in the U.S. anymore. We're a service economy. I say, well, that's just not true, right? I mean, we're one of the largest manufacturers in the world by output. Now, partly, we're the biggest economy, so that's easy. But we're also one of the top three exporters of manufactured goods in the world, which means that those goods that we're making here are competitive on global markets. And so I honestly just don't think it is the case that there's a deindustrialization plan. I think a lot of the steps we've been talking about up here are important, and I think there was a period over the previous decade where manufacturing really did take a big hit in the United States. But I think over the last 5 years, you do see a rebound, and I think a lot of the policies that people have talked about have been important in that.
Yes, we have a question right here, and there's a microphone coming up from behind you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm the president of Seguero's International Group. We focus on small businesses in Africa. Looking at your discussion, Africa, the U.S. government has an initiative with Africa, and we work with small and medium companies in Africa. Looking at the German model, African small and medium companies are not like U.S. small and medium companies. So what would you advise the best way for manufacturing in Africa and exporting to other countries, just international? Like here we are talking about Klopo. Africa maybe is not there, or what they manufacture is not good or may be good. But how do we make it happen for growth and development looking at manufacturing in Africa? Thank you.
Okay, great question. Any one of our panels?
So I'll say we've talked a little bit about this on the global stage, and I think that we all need Africa to succeed and grow. And part of that is the development of innovative technologies. I think having the opportunity to create place-based manufacturing first on the front end, and that's going to require a skilled and trained workforce and the utilization of work-based learning models like apprenticeship. It's going to begin to create that opportunity. I think there's a huge opportunity in the global supply chain and the value chain to help grow. I would say if I were looking at sectors, I probably wouldn't start with something like automotive. It tends to be place-based, and you got to start to build the middle class to make that production happen there. But I see that there's huge opportunity, and some of the stuff that we looked at from a case study perspective would validate that.
Right. Add one thing just quickly. I think one of the things that the United States has an opportunity to improve, and it pertains to your question, actually, and that is to deeper understand one of the things that our European counterparts and, in fact, many other people around the world have the advantage of is the different language skills and different cultural experiences. We have, most of us, grown up in this country, which, you know, whether we have a different culture in different parts of the country or not, we live under one sort of flag, you know, and one language and one currency. And so I think There is no question, I don't think anybody could debate, every single company in the world is probably looking at Africa as their greatest opportunity. The question is, for a small company, the need to know the culture, to understand how to go about this, it's a bit scary. But I think we all are looking at this as a huge opportunity. I know my company is.
Okay, other questions? Yeah, and near the back on the aisle, right there. Yep.
Thank you. Ken Jarboe with the National Academy of Engineering. My question is, how do we deal with the companies that are lagging? We did a study last year that came out called Making Value that pointed out that the frontier companies are doing very fine. They're innovative. They're productive. They employ a lot of people. Same finding from OECD recently on their look at productivity. The problem isn't the good companies, the frontier companies. It's everybody else in a sector. How do we help those laggard manufacturing companies, the ones that think they're doing okay but really aren't, how do we bring them up to where the frontier companies are in terms of productivity and innovation?
Panels? Don't be shy. Eric, you want to jump in?
Well, I can, let's say, share my experience again. I believe this is what I was saying before. As long as we are not all convinced that manufacturing is important for the country overall, because this is job, but not only in manufacturing, in services around, in everything. As long as we don't get it right in our mind at all level in the society, we will not succeed. And when this is the case, I tell you, those companies will work together. I was very impressed also in Germany, the fact that companies are working together to succeed. So German company will go abroad together to fight for new market or even inside the country. Until the end, they work together. And the smaller company, not, let's say, the biggest one, the strongest one, but even the one which are in the middle, are teaming up together in order to become better. And this is a mindset. This is something we should all fight for. So I know it's difficult. I know each country has a different way of working, but this is also solidarity. And this is something that some country understood well and do. And I believe there is a huge potential in that field, actually.
So if I can add on to that, I would say the other thing is the frontier companies are only as strong as their weakest supplier. And this really is an ecosystem, which, again, I think is one of those, you know, there was a time period where it was about squeezing costs out, and that's not really the environment anymore. It's about the partnerships that get built. I also do think that this is where government here in the United States does try to help through things like the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, trying to help companies think about their repositioning on that front. But I really do think it's the ecosystem approach here in the United States that's part of bringing those manufacturers to the table. And I will say, I realize that's incredibly difficult in the context of they're just busy trying to survive and, you know, keep things growing and think about the next marketplace while worrying about the person that's getting ready to retire that could walk out the door tomorrow. So it's incredibly complex. But I do think we overcome that through the ecosystem that happens with benchmarking the leading companies and pulling good strategy and tactics down through the supply chain. And I do see those actions happening more and more. And then through networks like the innovation hubs or the manufacturing extension partnerships, we do create a support mechanism to make it cost effective to get to the changes that need to happen.
Antoine has a question here. And I should point out, Antoine has a terrific new book on brainiac cities and innovations that are taking place, which I recommend all of you. Antoine.
Thank you for the plug. I had a question that, when I was writing this book, really intrigued me. In this country, and I'm originally from Europe, in this country, we're very good at promoting startups. We are terrible at helping mid-sized companies. Germany is not so good at promoting startups. It's very good at, as you say, at helping, supporting, in all the ways that you mentioned, mid-sized companies. What could we do at a policy level, this is really addressed to you, better to kind of get away from this, just as we have a college fixation, we have a startup fixation, to get away from that a bit and do a bit more for mid-sized companies, particularly as one of the people here just said, the laggards. How can we help the laggards? Because I think that's really a critical question.
So I guess I separated a little bit between the laggards and the mid-sized companies, because I think the real question is how to get the mid-sized companies that aren't laggards and how to help them grow. I do think one of the things that we've tried to recognize a lot in the last few years is that as much as I've talked a bunch about how U.S. manufacturing is globally competitive and a large share of output is exported, exporting's hard. You know, it's annoying. You know, we've got this big market where we all share one currency and one tax system, and that makes life easier. And then all of a sudden you have to deal with currency risk, and you have to deal with tariff laws, and you have to deal with a bunch of stuff. And so there are a lot of firms who don't, as you say, they're busy. They've got a lot of other things going on. They don't want to make that leap because the fixed cost of entering a new market is high. And I think there's been better recognition. You know, economists often will talk about countries trading, but countries don't trade, companies do. And so trying to get past that idea that we need to make it easier for these mid-sized companies to enter the global marketplace, and that will help them grow faster and help them move from that kind of stuck in the middle zone portion. So I think that has been one thing, that there's been more policy aimed at trying to make sure that that trade agreements that are negotiated really focus on how will these affect small and mid-sized enterprises, and will they be able to enter these new markets that are being opened, and trying to make sure that whether it's commerce or in particular through commerce and the International Trade Administration, making sure there are people around the country who can make it easier for a firm to export. They can go somewhere and be told, look, these are the rules you have to follow. These are the things we can help you with. These are the consulates that are overseas that can help you if you want to travel. This is how you do it. And I do think that's one piece of it. I do think the manufacturing hubs, I think some of the networks we've talked about are another piece of that, trying to make sure these firms, they have an idea, they start to grow, the startup works, they're surviving, and then they get stuck of making sure they get integrated into the supply chains, into global supply chains, into national supply chains, so that they can keep growing.
Johnny?
Yeah, Antoine, to kind of take that in a different, in a nutshell kind of for myself, and this may not sound very nice, but I think it's honest. There's a lot of resources to draw from. Ex-Im Bank, the National Association of Manufacturers. I mean, go on and on, right? I think at some point, if we're lagging, it's our responsibility to figure it out. When I began running Taco, it was not in good shape. And I didn't wait around for anybody to help me. I had to go at it. And we did, with our people, by the way. That was why we won. But at some point we have to we're grown ups, right? And so I think we have to go find those resources at some point. I mean, sure, it's nice to have somebody come in with a handout, but or whatever that is. But I think we need to go find that handout, right? To some extent.
In the very back, the woman in the very back. Yeah, if we can get her.
Hi, my name is Christabel, and I'm from the University of Waterloo. And I just had a question when it comes to the environment specifically. Often companies, especially in manufacturing, when you alter technology or alter investment technology in order to accommodate environmental sustainability, the argument is made that it reduces efficiency. So I just had a question about what you think finding or how you think companies can find a balance, or what you think the balance is, if there is one, between environmental sustainability and efficiency.
Well, you would be great for this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I guess this is again what a company purpose is at the end, and whether you are short-term oriented or long-term. If you just focus on short-term profit, then you have to make a choice. If you have a long-term view, you can do both. And this is also something which is key for the future. It's finding the right balance and not having the pressure of the time. And again, I refer to my experience with Velo, the German company, growing nicely for the last decades, born 145 years ago, and still growing and still able to balance short-term interest, or let's say putting that a bit aside, but keeping the vision long-term, how to make sure that you reach your goal. And this is, you have a social responsibility, you have an environmental responsibility, and you need to survive. And as Johnny was saying, you need to fight, you need to find the resource. It's not that someone will do it for you, but you will have a surrounding that will be more or less favorable, and then you have to find your way. But the beauty, actually, and this is a luxury, being into a foundation-owned company, family-owned company, you can really take all those elements and not let one aside because of short-term result orientation, actually.
Okay, there's a gentleman in the very back who...
Can I make one addition
sure.
to that? You know, the NAM just launched a blog series on sustainability, highlighting company actions. And I will say, and some of this I think gets lost when people paint a broad brush as to manufacturing. Fundamental to the DNA of any manufacturer I've ever met is, how do you do more with less? It's fundamentally about reducing impact across every business element. It is in their DNA to be thinking about that every single day. And I think that's a piece of the manufacturing story that gets lost in this discussion. It's what they wake up every single day and start to think about. So there are some of those best practices that are now on the NAM One site as well.
Okay, question in the back.
Yes, sir. Adele Ratcliffe, Department of Defense. We've been spearheading many of the manufacturing innovation institutes that you discussed. In our conversation with industry, we've kind of gotten a mixed message lately, and I'd like your thoughts on this. It's one thing to have manufacturing exist and talk about workforce development going into that existing manufacturing. But a lot of the conversation we're having with industry right now indicates that the next generation is not really they're receiving mixed messages on whether the next generation is entrepreneurial focused. I'd like your thoughts on whether or not you think this next generation has a willingness to go into business, much less whether it's related to manufacturing, which is the next harder challenge.
I find myself speaking about the millennial generation quite a bit. We do a lot with youth engagement across the country. And I would say I do consider them entrepreneurial and a tremendous asset. And the other thing that I think is a great opportunity for our nation's manufacturers is they want to contribute today. They want to show up, be engaged, be active, be a part of the solution. And when I talk to a lot of young people and I think about sort of the global challenges we face in the world, those solutions are actually manufacturing solutions. So talking to young people about the ability to be engaged in solving the global health challenges and solving the global environmental challenges, there's some huge opportunity, and I see that from an entrepreneurial perspective, but I also see that from an engagement and leadership perspective. And I do think we culturally need to be ready in manufacturing to take advantage of the asset the next generation is bringing towards us, because they're our frontline managers today.
The only thing I add to that is I think there has been, over the last few years, an increasing emphasis on STEM education in a lot of places, where you're trying to make sure that you've got people who are engineers, who think about making things, who think about how do we do more with less, who are thinking about these challenges. And when you have that background, it's, you know, lots of people who do that wind up then saying, well, I have an idea I want to run with. And so I think you do have that background. Sure, there are lots of people who are interested in the tech fields and in software or in finance. But even on the finance side, I think there has been a bit of a shift in the last 7 years where fewer people are heading that direction, and they are thinking about engineering and making things as more of a career path.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Okay, there's a gentleman right here. I think we'll have to make this the last question of this panel, and then we'll head straight into our 10 o'clock panel.
Stanley Kober. I'm looking at an article, Euro edges lower on soft German manufacturing. German manufacturing today, the numbers came in well below expectations, the third decline in 4 months. And it's not because the Germans are not competitive. It's weak global conditions. And this begs a question. We've been talking about supply. What if consumer preferences have changed? If people buy a new car every 10 years instead of every 3 years, that's going to affect manufacturing, won't it?
If I could just jump one quick thing. I don't know that you want to make the leap to – I think your raising demand is really important, and it's actually something I hope to talk about quickly at one point. But I don't know that it's a preferences issue, right? I think we have had periods where there's been inadequate global demand ever since the global financial crisis. I think that probably – if I had to guess what was going on with concerns over Germany right now, it would be that post-Brexit, there's some uncertainty. There's worry that some firms will be investing less within the EU and that that'll be bad for the capital machinery exporters from Germany. And I think that it is one reason why the U.S., I think, frankly, more than many other countries, has put an emphasis in its macro policy on making sure there's adequate demand in the economy. It's why we've gotten the G7 and the G20 to start making statements along those lines a lot more, that we need to use our policy tools to make sure there's adequate demand because, as you say, the people up here can come up with as many good products as they want. If no one's buying, that's a problem. But I don't think that's a preferences issue as much as just an overall amount of demand issue.
Okay, we're out of time on this panel, but I want to thank Johnny, Eric, Jay, and Jennifer. We really appreciate you sharing your insights. Terrific job. And then we will invite the next panel to come up right away. But please join me in thanking this. Thank you.
Leah Gilliam.
Yeah.
If you want to put it in, down in here, good. That's fine.
Is that okay for you?
Works for
okay,
me.
Thank you. Morning.
Good morning.
Sure.
Yeah, my hair will swing the other way. So.
Okay. Your microphones are on. Okay.
Okay, are we ready to start? All right. Good morning, everyone. Give you all a second to grab a seat. So my name is Ashley Smith. I'm a reporter with Inside Higher Ed, and I am joined this morning by these wonderful three people here who are doing very unique things when it comes to building student skills and employee skills in the workplace. I'm joined by Marianne Pacelli. Did I say that correct?
Yes.
She's the Workforce Development Manager with the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Walter Singenthaler.
Yeah.
He's Executive Vice President of the Datewiler Corporation. And Leah Gillum, she is Vice President of Strategy, Innovation, and Education with Girls Who Code. So I will start with Mary Ann. If you don't mind just sort of giving us an idea of what you do, and I understand that you help small companies with this type of issue, if you want to start there.
Right. I'm with the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, which is part of NIST. The MEP system's been around about 28 years, and our focus is working with small, mid-sized manufacturers across the country. So we, at the national level, fund cooperative agreements, one center at least in every state, who is out there to reach out to small, mid-sized manufacturers, and I help them identify what their challenges might be, not specifically workforce, but across all of their business challenges, and then help them find the resources, whether it's connecting them as an intermediary to the universities or the educational system, or doing some hands-on consulting with helping them look at their business, what are their growth issues, what are their technology issues, what are their process and innovation challenges, and how can the MEP network, through the networks of the institutes and the labs and national federal labs across the country, help these companies innovate and grow. So from the workforce perspective, our centers, as even was highlighted in our panel previous, all of our manufacturers are challenged with growth, accessing technology, new product development, exporting, all of those wonderful things, but one of the number one challenges that they all are facing right now is developing the future workforce, the current and future workforce, in order to help them grow. And our small mid-sized manufacturers are the ones who are going to grow the most, and it's a challenge for them because they are resource constrained. So our centers are out there trying to figure out how do we help those companies with that workforce challenge.
And Walter, why don't you tell us about some of the partnerships that you've built?
We are a small manufacturer with 75 people, so obviously we have a challenge to form something big. So 20 years ago, we actually formed a partnership called Apprenticeship 2000 with other companies in our area to really promote apprenticeships or get an apprenticeship program going. Over the 20 years as a partnership, we have graduated 128 apprentices and have, I think, something like 54 of them in the program right now. Really, the main reason we did it as a partnership is because we alone could not have done it. And especially with the academic part of it, we work together with Central Piedmont Community College in Charlotte. And they would not do anything because as Detweiler, we have one or two apprentices per year, and obviously they couldn't do anything special. So as a partnership, we get enough mass going so we can actually fill a whole class. Typically, a community college needs at least 10, 12 students in a class to be able to do something special. Central Piedmont does some special classes. They run classes specifically just for us. And so there's a lot of communication, a lot of coordination which has to go on. When we started, CPCC already offered a lot of the classes we needed, but one of them on Monday, another one on Tuesday, two on Thursday or whatever. And so we had to teach them to say, hey, our apprentices need to have all their classes in one day because we only want to send them to school one day because we need to train them hands-on the other days. So that it takes a lot of work, but in a larger group, this is possible. Our program, we start our apprentices as seniors in high school. So the first year, they have to go to high school, of course. They have to finish high school. So they have to go to high school half a day, work at the company the other half of the day. And then after they graduate from high school, it's three more years where they go to school at the community college for one day a week and work at the shop for 4 days a week. They end up with an associate's degree in mechatronics and, of course, a journeyman certificate from the state. So it works very well for us, and it's really a copy of the European program. We are a Swiss company. another partner company is based in Austria, and other ones in Germany. So we pulled really things together from the different parts to create the program, very similar to what has been very successful over in Germany, Switzerland, and Austria. So it works for us, and we have in the meantime in North Carolina expanded. We have helped to get other programs started. So we have in North Carolina 7 programs like that in different areas, which we have supported to get going.
Okay. And Leah, why don't you tell us about Girls Who Code?
Sure. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here today. Girls Who Code is a 4-year-old national organization. Our focus is really on closing the achievement and gender gap in technology and computing fields. We have 2 free programs that we run nationally. And I think what's most relevant for the discussion today is the work that we do through our summer immersion program. And through that program, we create classrooms of 20 young women with 2 teaching assistants, 2 teachers, and we embed those classrooms in technology companies and in institutions of higher education. And our focus there is to do a 7-week intensive computer science course, really to try and create this intervention that helps girls to really understand the sort of essential fundamental ideas of computer science, also of computational thinking, problem solving, loops, algorithms, all the kind of technical stuff. And then also, you know, by having these classrooms embedded in technology companies, we work with the corporate partners to really help them see and develop the young talent that's so important to really widen and change the kind of pipeline issue that we have in terms of technology fields. And then we will work with the corporate partners to bring in mentors, to have field trips, to really think about what it means to embed a classroom of young women and to begin to understand what their needs are, what their ideas are, and to really begin to see the real difference that a more diverse and inclusive workforce can make in their workplace. We really see these corporate partners as kind of key to the work that we do, and they subsequently see us as a big part of that work as well. So, you know, the classrooms that we have at Twitter, they'll sort of talk about, like, how are our girls doing at Twitter? So we really see that, you know, when you have girls who are coming into a company, you know, for 7 weeks in the summer, that you sort of begin, that sort of the two cultures begin to get a sense of how one and the other works. And for the young women, it becomes really essential for them to get a sense of, you know, what it looks like to actually apply the kinds of skills that they're learning into technology companies and in the computing field. We don't imagine that every young woman is going to go into a technology field, but just in terms of the way, you know, we see computer science and computational thinking, you know, is essentially the new liberal arts. It's something that underlies so many of the different aspects of our culture and of our business economy. So we see this as a really kind of essential piece of our work. We have a national after school program that is much more kind of akin to a club structure. That's a little bit more community sort of based and community grown. But the summer immersion program is just launching. The DC area programs just launched last Monday. So we're super excited. We'll be working with over 1,500 girls this summer.
Wow. So what are some of the skills gaps or some of the issues that the partners that you're working with, what are they looking for when they come to you?
Well, from the MEP perspective, our centers are working with small, mid-sized companies on a regular basis. And the skills gap, there's a lot written up out there right now trying to define it, but the struggle, and it was brought up in our last panel too, is the numbers of young people that are our best and our brightest are not necessarily choosing manufacturing and technical fields as their choice of work. So part of it is trying to encourage and re-advertise and republicize and create the the great community of why, what are the jobs, what are the careers available to you after high school, whether you move on to a 1 or 2 year certificate at a community college and or want to move on to a 4 year degree. We are seeing how do we help build that future pipeline. Many of the young people that are moving out of high school are right away moving into college or moving into the service sector and aren't even aware of what is available. Our manufacturers today at the frontline level are looking for people who want to work there and can train and can learn the job. And so technical skills today in a frontline manufacturing job, whether it's entry level or moving up into what we call the middle skills level, such as mechatronics, you need a real strong high school STEM education. Liberal arts core, being able to read, write, communicate, being able to do basic problem solving, understanding math, being able to learn higher order thinking and learn some of the computer skills after high school that you need. Those are skills that we want. Many of those young people are not necessarily knocking on the doors of our small manufacturers. So our challenge first is trying to figure out how to get some of those students to strongly consider those jobs.
Well, just loading right onto that, we have a problem. Awareness of in high school is not there, what manufacturing has to offer. We are putting in a lot of effort. It's basically a full-year cycle where we do the recruiting. We invite career counselors to come in, offer them a luncheon so they keep them happy, and, of course, introduce them to the program, also give them a plant tour. It's very, very important that they see what's going on, what today's manufacturing is, because there's still a lot of misconceptions about manufacturing, the 3Ds, dirty, dangerous, and dark. They're still out there, and that's not what today's manufacturing is anymore. But then, really, with the counselors, we inform them and tell them what we are looking for. We're looking for really smart young people, but the ones who like to work with their hands. And they're out there, but we have to find them. So the career counselors then, in some schools it works better than in other ones, they go back and select some of their potential students. We then go to the high school, give a presentation to show them what is going on. And usually we take one of our apprentices with them, because if an old guy like me stands in front of 15, 16-year-old kids, that just doesn't work very well, so we bring the juniors with us and show them what's happening. If they're interested, then they can come to an open house. One condition we have with the open house is that they have to bring a parent or legal guardian with them, because we want to get them right involved, because a lot of the parents have misconceptions about apprenticeships, about manufacturing and so on. So it's important. Again, part of the open house, of course, is the presentation of the program as well as a plant tour. So they see what that is. Out of that, whoever is still interested, we have what we call orientation. That's 4 evenings after school. That's typically in February. When after school they come in, we work a project with them for about 3-4 hours, so they get some hands-on work done, so they see, okay, is this really what I like? And of course we see, is this student really capable of doing things like that? And then what we have ongoing right now is the last step, that's a 6-week internship, it's paid, during the summer between the junior year and senior year, and out of that group we pick who is getting into the apprenticeship program. So it's very selective, but I don't have any qualms being selective, because we are investing a lot of money into those young people, so any scholarship of $150,000 is also selective, so I don't have a problem doing that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I think certainly it is definitely an issue of awareness. I really agree. And then, you know, as I said before, it's really also this issue of this real gap in achievement. We really know from the research that there are certain groups, because of historical and institutional barriers really have had a hard time understanding what the sort of possibilities are when it comes to working with technology, whether that's manufacturing or whether that's more, you know, kind of computational computer science fields, the way that that Girls Who Code has thought about initially. What we're really finding, though, is that through our clubs program, there are a range of different companies and local efforts that really help our young women begin to understand the range of roles that they can roles and professions that they can explore. So we're really finding that, you know, although initially our organization focused on, you know, sort of 11 specific cities, Austin, Atlanta, New York, the Bay Area, you know, sort of 11, you know, kind of key markets, that as we continue to expand and really see, you know, what are the opportunities that are available for the young women that we've worked with, many of whom, you know, who are in junior high or in high school, we're really increasingly looking to smaller businesses, you know, to local manufacturing as well, to really help think about who can actually see the kinds of skills and the kinds of opportunities that are available to a wide range of people across the United States. So we are really thinking specifically about what are those ways that we can build awareness so that young women have a sense of the kinds of opportunities that are available, you know, in their neighborhood or in their area. So we're working, you know, very concretely with our clubs program this year to really think about how we begin to help young women see what those opportunities are. So our clubs program is in 42 states right now, and we have over 460 clubs across 42 states. So that, to us, opens up a really interesting kind of opportunity to begin to think, okay, if you're not at Facebook, if you're not at, you know, Lockheed Martin, what are the other ways that you can use the kinds of skills that you're learning through Girls Who Code, and what are those future opportunities?
You're talking about expansion. I'm just wondering, for Marianne and Walter, are you all looking at broadening to other companies to expand your apprenticeship programs at all to raise awareness in that way?
Through the MEP, each center, each state, you know, kind of works in their own region, and some things that were mentioned in the previous panel about really needing to be a community. What we're encouraging, what our centers are trying to encourage, is getting programs like an Apprenticeship 2000, whether it's apprenticeship focused or just skills and certification focused. How do we get like companies that have like needs together in a small region where, just like a small company, as you mentioned, you don't have the horsepower to go knock on a school's door and say, hey, customize an entire program for me. I have three people that I need to be trained. I'll close the door. So how do we get four or five of those companies together to do some very specific skills training, whether it's for new employees working with the workforce system, finding some of those new employees that we need to hire, or even upskilling the existing workforce that I have? I've hired some entry-level people. I've changed my technology. I now have to move this level of people into a new technology, new operations system, or I have to grow my own maintenance people because they're not on the street. So how do we combine a few companies together, work with the educational system, create boot camps, long-term certificate programs that are working in that particular community, and perhaps find some national funding or some local funding to help offset that where possible? But companies have to put some of their own investment into it also and really develop their local regional workforce themselves. So our centers are working as intermediaries in most cases, working with the educational system, groups of small companies, and on a regular basis customizing the programs that they need, and then working to continue to fill that pipeline. How do we get more small companies to open their doors to student tours? MEP was one of the founding partners of Manufacturing Day, October 7th this year coming up. But we look at every day should be Manufacturing Day. But what are those? How do we get more and more companies to think about how do they market themselves to the community as we are a viable entity in your community, and we want we want the individuals in that community to consider working for us? The networking of the community of smaller manufacturers in each area is really something that has to grow much stronger.
On our end, we, you know, besides what I had mentioned before about recruiting, we also do a lot of just shop tours or Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District has a really interesting program which we have participated in over the last 3 years. It's called STEMmersion. They take teachers who teach in the STEM curriculum during the summer for 2 weeks, and they move them every day to another company. So they spend a day at different companies to see what's going on. And it's amazing to hear the comments when we get them out on the shop, and we bring them out to the machines, and they actually, we let them operate some of the machines, and we work a project with them. At the end, they have to, they get a box of parts, and they have to assemble a little pen holder and so on. And but some of the comments were, I had no idea that math is needed on a milling machine. Because I have to say, where would they know from if they don't have that opportunity? So I think it's very important that we as manufacturers really open our door and educate the people. I'm spending a lot of time going around, and, well, that's also why I'm sitting here, I guess. But especially in North Carolina, also for a few days ago, I'm not anymore the chairman of the, but I was for the last 10 years the chairman of the North Carolina Apprenticeship Council. I'm still a member of the council, and that's where we helped through part of it through the council, part of it through just connections with friends or what. If we know of somebody that is interested, we help them to support how to set up a program. And I'm doing quite a bit of that also over the phone. I'll have a phone conversation with a company in Connecticut tomorrow because they're interested and they like to know how we do it just to learn. And I think I feel our program is really working. I'm not saying that's the only way of doing it, but that's one way of doing it. And so we are very supportive. Yeah, we could say, hey, we got our program. We are happy, so why should I tell anybody? But we believe that apprenticeships are very, very important for the future of manufacturing, and that's why we put so much effort into it.
I think there's an interesting kind of call to action that's developing here. I'm really thinking about what are the ways that you market your companies, market your opportunities in unique ways so that people actually get a real sense of what the work looks like. And we think about that a lot, and we talk about that a lot at Girls Who Code, because there's, you know, when you talk about computer science, when you talk about technology fields, everyone sort of imagines the Mark Zuckerberg sort of, you know, someone in a basement in a hoodie who hasn't seen the light of day in 5 years, who's just coding night and day, and people really, you know, don't have a sense that, you know, that actually coding is really collaborative work, and working computationally can be, can call on a number of different skills. And I think it's really a very similar thing when you think about the manufacturing skills, so the manufacturing kind of industry as well. So I love these examples where you're really sort of thinking about what are ways that you create kind of hands-on, you know, real-time experiences for young people, for underskilled workers to really begin to understand what does this work look like. Find a Girls Who Code club in your region and see if you can create some kind of experience with them. Field trips, hackathons, boot camps, all those things are really great ways to bring in new audiences and have them just experiment and understand what these things look like. Because I think there's a way in which, obviously, in such a digitally sort of focused culture, we really forget, right, that you can work with your hands, that it draws on math and STEM and all of these other, you know, kind of areas of specialty. So I think I'm really excited by these sort of ideas, and I think it's a great kind of call to action to all of us to really think about how do you give real kind of hands-on experiences so people begin to understand what this work looks like.
The interesting thing is that you all have talked about how unprepared students are when they come to you or when they enter the apprenticeships or when they come to Girls Who Code. And I wonder if maybe you all can just kind of talk about the role that outside companies are playing by basically stepping into where the education space may have failed. It seems as if you all have answered a call here to go in and fill in the gaps of where maybe a high school education didn't really help or didn't prepare.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in. I think one thing that we've really found with Girls Who Code, and increasingly that although we are working with companies, it's really the individuals and the companies that are really stepping forward. So right now we see that there are, you know, individual engineers who will come into a classroom and or, you know, devote time and mentor there are, you know, individual people who will come in and sort of talk about their, will talk about their experience. But, you know, to me, the real sort of like warriors in our story are the local volunteers who are running Girls Who Code clubs. So, you know, 4 to 8 hours a week. You know, it, running an after-school club, coming from their, you know, day-to-day jobs. Some of them are teachers. Some of them work in industry. Some of them work in technology fields. This is unpaid, you know, labor. They're volunteering to really mentor and help a group of young women to really understand the computing field and to understand technology. Increasingly, we're really finding that you don't have to have a specialized computer science background to really facilitate this kind of work. And so we're increasingly really thinking about what are those kinds of relationships, what are those, what is the sort of volunteer mechanism in which you're able to invite more individuals into this sort of larger kind of community and to see themselves as someone who can, you know, if you have 4 to 6 hours or if you have 8 hours or if you have 2 hours, that you can offer your time and your experience and your workplace and give someone else a sense of what that work looks like. So I think it's been a very interesting kind of relationship.
I mean, I don't like to use the word failure of the education system. I come from a long line of teachers. I have to be careful. But I think some of the deficiencies are, and we've talked about this, the access, the students' awareness of why am I learning what I'm learning? I mean, if I knew why I needed to learn trig back in high school, I mean, I learned it because somebody said you have to, you know, pass this course and get a good score on your SAT. Then I go out into the real world and I'm working in a community college and I'm learning how to run a CNC machine because I'm starting to do workforce development. Well, wow, look at there. There's, you know, cosines and everything on the prints that they're trying to teach me to read. So we have to look at how do we start building that application, and not just for manufacturing, but as we're teaching our students the basics, the math, the reading, the English, why am I learning this, and where am I really going to apply this basic algebra and basic geometry? There's some examples of that. One of the National Network of Manufacturing Institutes in Detroit, the one called LIFT, which is focused on lightweight materials, they've really started funding in the 5 states that are part of the partnership some workforce development activities to just figure out how do we, again, continue to get more students open and aware of what are some of the new things going on in manufacturing. And a couple of the major things, projects that they're funding, I think Kentucky is one of the leads for this, is some teacher education, and we're helping teachers develop lesson plans in math, science, and even, you know, English and reading where possible, where they work with a manufacturer and they can develop in 6th, 7th, 8th grade math and science classes. Okay, I'm going to teach you the basics of geometry, and now we're going to do a couple exercises where we're going to show you where this is applied. We piloted this when I was in Ohio. We had an Alcoa engineer work with a teacher in the Cleveland Public Schools, and they just decided to, okay, we're going to create a few lesson plans, and the engineer comes into the classroom one day and brings out the Alcoa plant in Cleveland is making the wheel hubs for airplanes. He rolls one into the classroom, and everyone just went, ooh. And very easily in a 6th and 7th grade math environment was able to explain what they're learning and how it applies to the role that he has as an engineer along with the technicians that are on the floor. So that's where we need to build that, and teachers can't do it by themselves. So we're trying to figure out how to get more industry involved in helping those teachers create better lesson plans, do the plant tours, and very clearly show that link with what you're learning, and here's how it's applied, and whether you go into manufacturing or not, you better hope that somebody else is learning it because you're going to ride on that airplane someday. So, but those are the kinds of things that our schools have to get better at, and we as the industry have to help them do that because they can't do it alone.
I think, you know, I mentioned the immersion before. I think I'm convinced every teacher that goes through that immersion program in Charlotte, they're teaching different afterwards, mm-hmm. because they know why they're teaching what they're teaching, why, where it is applied. If they can get that across to the students, I think they will learn a lot better. So there is a lot we need to do, and I think it goes back to, well, over I don't know how long, everybody said everybody has to get a four-year degree. Well, if you get a four-year, if your plan is to go to college, you don't necessarily at that point have to know what's going on afterwards. Unfortunately, you get a really bad awakening after college, at least a lot of them, if they can figure out, oh, and now I got a degree, and what am I going to do with this? There has to be a plan, and that's one of the things I always tell people. Don't just go, there's nothing wrong with college, but don't just go to college just to get a degree. You have to know what you want to do with it. And that's the same thing when we start apprentices. They have to be sure that's really what they want to do. And it doesn't mean that an apprentice is going to stay and in that field or on the machine. I made an apprenticeship as a machinist. Obviously, I'm not out in the shop on the milling machine and the lathe anymore. There are plenty of opportunities out of it, but it gives a good base. And it's just that awareness, again, that they know. The students we are taking into the program, I'm convinced each one of them could go to a four-year college. There's no question about it. They have the smarts. There's no doubt in my mind. But they don't necessarily want to sit in a school bench for 4 years. They like to work with their hands. And part of our evaluation is we try to find out what they do at their own time. And since we spend so much time during the recruiting with them, we learn a lot about them. And if they fix their cars at home, well, that's a good sign. That's just the first thing. And one of the things which is missing in a lot of the schools is those hands-on classes. Woodworking or whatever was there, a lot of them disappeared. And so we have to slowly try to get them back so that we need people who work with their hands. We can't just mention sometimes we can't just cut each other's hair. That's not going to get us anywhere. So we need to produce something.
Well, I want to open it up to questions now. If you all have anything to ask, yes. Someone's coming with a microphone.
Hi, my name is Shirin Köprüce, and I'm a global skills trainer and market entry consultant. From my understanding with the first panel, as well as from your discussions, I understand culture actually is a very important important element in being motivated for the manufacturing industry, as well as developing productive development opportunities, such as the apprenticeship program, for instance. So I was wondering if you have encountered cultural differences as you were introducing apprenticeship programs in your company, as well as a community leader, and what the reactions of other panelists would be with regards to that. That's one question. And the second question is where you found points of connection with the American community, especially with American youth. I hope they are not too complex questions. Thank you.
Well, I may start out with the first one. We clearly see differences where our company is located. The closest high school is North Mecklenburg High School. Huge high school, I think 2,000 students or what or more. We basically get nobody out of there. And I think that's just the difference there because, okay, Charlotte is the second largest banking center, and we are very close to Lake Norman. So a lot of the higher influence people are living in that area, and they don't necessarily want to send their kids into manufacturing. So it's very difficult for us to find. I'm convinced there are enough of them there that we could fill our program, but finding them is very, very difficult. We are more successful recruiting out in some more rural areas because we have one apprentice right now who's going to graduate in August. I was at his home about a year ago, and he's out in the boonies, let's say, and he fixes his car every weekend. He works on his car, or he bought himself a house next to his parents' house, and he's adding an addition to it. He is constantly working on it. And obviously, in a urban area, you can't do that. So there are clearly differences, and the kids don't get exposed to it because there is no possibility. So there is a lot, we see a lot of a difference there. And yes, it has a lot to do also how it is promoted. If the school doesn't promote it, or in some cases we see differences some of our partner companies actually recruit out of South Carolina. And for whatever reason, okay, so South Carolina is also more of a rural area in general anyway, but they get a lot more support from the schools than we get in Mecklenburg County. So we go outside of Mecklenburg County, and I would say in our case, more than half of the students are not from Mecklenburg County where we are located.
Anyone else want to answer?
Well, culture is, it's a big word. And there's, in the manufacturing sector, especially small, mid-sized manufacturing companies, and a lot of my hands-on experience has been in the Midwest, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, doing consulting for those companies. It is changing, finally, as ownership changes over, because some of the culture comes from the top, and it was a struggle getting younger, today's younger people, the Gen Y and millennials, to feel comfortable in the traditional manufacturing environment, because many times the leadership in these small companies, let's face it, they're still living in 1950, and they are starting to change as the generations of ownerships are changing. And now we have to re-advertise back into the culture that there is a different work opportunity, and millennials and young people today can feel comfortable in what looked like a traditional workplace, top-down, top-driven. But as we become more productive and we look to engage our employees, which we have to do in a flattened organization, leadership that is changing and accepting of the fact that just because somebody comes to me without a college degree doesn't mean that they can't think and that they can't be as engaging and as supportive and really helpful to solving the problems of my workplace. As that's happening, the culture in these organizations is changing and becoming more welcoming to the younger worker of today who wants to come in and hit the ground running and isn't into that, I need to pay my dues and shut up for the next 5 years and take lots of orders until somebody asks me a question. We want our young people today to learn very quickly and become engaged in the organization. But it's a slow change. As companies, leadership changes over, cultures are changing. But there's still the perception that manufacturing is a little bit more heavy-handed than other organizations.
I saw a question over here. Yes?
Hi, my name is Cristian Ungarotti from the Embassy of Italy. I have a question especially for Mr. Siegenthaler. I wanted to ask if you have any experience of this kind of system which you use for apprenticeship in high school and this very segment, young segment of students. Also in the higher education, I mean, have you ever tried to implement this system, combining in a systematic way work and theory for, like, position in management, high engineering, and so on?
Well, obviously, manufacturing is not the only place for apprenticeships. And this is a manufacturing forum, that's why I'm mainly talking about manufacturing. But we're in, not just in North Carolina, I mean all over the United States, there is a push to get apprenticeships also into non-traditional areas. There is an insurance company in Illinois that just started an apprenticeship program. And I'm working with some banks to try to get something going there. There are other possibilities. It doesn't have to be hands-on. If you look at what's done in Europe, everybody basically goes through an apprenticeship program. In Switzerland, 64% of the young adults who are finishing mandatory school are going into an apprenticeship program. But that can be as an executive assistant, it can be as a dentist or a dentist assistant, it can be as a salesperson in a store. It just, we have apprenticeship programs for everything. We have a long, long way to go till we get anywhere near that. But I think I really feel if we can expand it into some of those non-traditional areas, that's going to help the overall, because then people get a better understanding what an apprenticeship program is, and that's going to make it easier also to find the ones who really want to get into manufacturing. But there is definitely, there's a lot of work to be done in that field, but it's starting to happen. There is a lot of effort, and, you know, I think it's a big push since President Obama declared that he wanted to double the number of apprentices in 5 years. So there's a lot of activity from the Department of Labor and so on to get into those non-traditional areas, because I think the number of potential students is much greater there.
There's a question in the back.
Thank you. My name is Kareem Shabaka. I'm with Brown Solutions International. I really don't know where to start, so I wish you would help me out. The school systems have failed, are failing. How much do you plan to engage local governance or state governance on the projects that you are doing to get more people involved or engaged? I'm talking about the students in your operation. Number one, I see a lot of people going towards NBA. If you can sing and dance, you know, and flip a burger, yeah, you got attraction. But I don't see too much in apprenticeship programs. How engaged are you? What kind of resources are necessary to improve your engagement? And how can would you say that I, as a business person, can see the positiveness coming from your participation or engagement? Thank you.
It's a good question, and there's probably, you know, we're a big country and we behave fairly regionally and state-based, in the way our businesses kind of combine in our little communities. An example of starting to bring together resources is actually something that was written up in Brookings just last year in Delaware. The Delaware MEP, which is the Manufacturing Extension Partnership, worked with the Delaware Department of Higher of Education, along with the Delaware Workforce System, which is our, you know, WIB, Workforce Investment System, and created with the Delaware Manufacturers Association, brought companies together and said, okay, we need to really look at a frontline manufacturing kind of career certificate to get people started. So they defined, with industry's input first, before the educators walked in the room, what is it that we really want students to learn? What do we need them to have? What does this look like from high school to perhaps the first year of community college? And they designed that career pathway. Then they brought the educators in the room and said, okay, what do you have and what can we do to help you augment it, enhance it, customize it, and add to it? The educators said, okay, through our CTE program, Career and Technical Education, vocational system, we have a lot of this, but let's figure out how do we tweak it, because industry was sitting there saying, you need to do this. The Department of Education said, we will support what changes you have to make, and the workforce system was saying, we'll figure out how to fund some of this too. So through all of that, we now have a state group of manufacturers who have agreed to a 1 or 2 year certificate from the last 2 years, junior, senior year of community of vocational school, perhaps 1 year of community college, and students and parents can see where the breakoff points are. If I finish my last 2 years of vocational school, at the end I graduate as a senior, but I have a certificate that's recognized in the state, perhaps a national certificate, and the manufacturers in that state have said, we will look at you and give you perhaps, give you more preference because you have that certificate as we look to hire. But then the community college system said, we're going to recognize what work you've done, so when you come to us, if you want to enroll in the community college, we're going to give you some credit for what you did in high school, which is happening in most states right now. There's dual enrollment, there's credit for experience. Everybody's looking at it differently. I wish we could have one system that looked at it the same. But we're all recognizing that we all have to work together. And that's just an example of, now, Delaware's a small state. How do you do that in Ohio and California? You almost have to do it county by county. But in a state, in a region, in a county, in an urban area, you need to bring everybody together, and they need to listen, and you need to have a strong facilitator, whether it's the MEP or the Manufacturing Association. But everybody has to be able to in a sense, compromise too and say, I'm willing to do something a little bit different and let's see if it works.
I think there are several other areas too, like Colorado is another area where they really have a program starting. They got everybody involved. Government is involved. Industry is involved. But I think no matter where you are, it needs to be industry-driven. That's the main thing, because we, as manufacturers, have to tell the educators what we need, and it needs to be driven. We can't just complain that we don't have the skilled labor and just sit there and wait for somebody to provide them. It's not going to happen. We need to get involved, and that's why we got involved 20 years ago. We said we couldn't find the people, and that's why we said we need to do something. And I think that's really... industry has to realize they have to put some effort into it. The schools are not going to give us the skilled labor we need totally prepared. That's just not going to happen. That does not work, especially not in manufacturing. Yes, the school can help us to provide them, prepare them for what we have to teach them, and that's where we have to work together with the schools and everybody to really improve that.
Yes.
I have two questions. First, if you look at it on a national scale, you have these individual state efforts, but if you look at it on a national scale, how much is this taking hold in the U.S.? Could you give us some sense of that, and could you point us to some studies on this? Second point is, what seems to be commonplace, Switzerland, Germany, Holland, Austria, Denmark, all over, with impressive numbers, as you cite, somehow isn't working here, although 50 years ago it existed. What are the key sort? There must be some resistance somewhere. And what is this resistance, and where does it come from?
Well, where does it come from? That's a good question. I think why it went there, I think there was way too long. As I said, it was just... Everybody needs to get a four-year degree. If you want to get anywhere, you have to have a four-year degree. And that is not the case. I also feel that manufacturing made some mistakes. That's, you know, looking at North Carolina, big part of manufacturing was textile. That was really the manufacturing we had. And it's all gone. I'm not saying we could have avoided everything, but I think if textile at that time would have done more about educating young people and invest into their business, get more modernized and so on, I think we would have a different picture today. But that's what we are struggling with in North Carolina right now, because a lot of the parents lost their jobs in textile. So they say, I don't want to send my kid into manufacturing. Look what happened to me. That's just going to disappear somewhere again. So it is difficult to say, okay, where did it come from? That's a trend which built. On the other hand, I have to say, looking at nationwide, I think we have really all over, I think we have activities all over the place. The USDOL generated that program, Apprenticeship USA Leaders, and we as Detweiler are one of them, and we have a commitment to promote apprenticeships. That's our commitment. And after a year, they check and say, hey, what have you done? So, and there are, we had a meeting here in Washington last year. There were over 100 of those apprenticeship leaders here. So there is activity. And being involved for 20 years in apprenticeships here in the U.S., I have never seen as much activity as over the last 2-3 years. It's definitely taking on. But we have a long way to go. We cannot, this is a big ship to turn around. We can't do that in 1 or 2 years. It's going to take a lot of time.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm Qi Han from Xinhua News Agency. Our follow-up question is that you said in the last 2 or 3 years, the apprenticeship is kind of booming in the U.S. So why it becomes popular in the last 2 or 3 years? And my second question is related to that, is that now in the media, we usually talk about the recovery of the U.S. manufacturer or the return of U.S. manufacturer. But some will argue that because of the technology improvement, although the U.S. Manufacturer has recovered a lot, but it employed less people. So is this one of the reasons that apprenticeship becomes more popular, because the manufacturer is booming, but it the requirement for its employees has also been raised? Thank you very much.
To the first question, I wouldn't say that apprenticeships are booming yet. It's being talked a lot more about it, but that doesn't mean that it really that apprenticeships are booming. There's a lot of talk. Now we have to also turn the talk into action. And then, of course, on the manufacturing end of it, today's manufacturing is different than what we had 20, 30 years ago. Everything is a lot more automated. Even if we get the same amount of manufacturing output, we are never going to be needing as many people anymore as we used to. But the people we need have to have higher skills. And that's where the difference is. It's that the employment number is not going to go back to where it was. But the higher skills there is higher skills needed, so therefore education is more important. You can't just take the people from the road and from the street and put them on a CNC milling machine. That just doesn't work.
Yeah, in manufacturing workforce has in numbers gone down as productivity has increased tremendously. Some of that has just been higher skilled workers, and a lot of it is through the opportunity of new technologies. Some of the words out there about the still big need for the manufacturing workforce is, we all probably know that there was some periods over the last 20 years of decreasing, and when companies were not hiring as many people, the people that they had stayed on, and so now you have an aging workforce. So the big need, when you hear the big numbers of manufacturers across the country, we're expecting that there's going to be millions of jobs that could potentially go unfilled. It's not increase in headcount, it's replacement headcount. And I would say probably 60-70% of that number is replacement headcount. And most plant managers today are losing a lot of sleep about what are they going to do. Some of that was augmented or pushed back in 2008-2009, the recession. People who may have retired at 55, 60 stayed on because their retirement funds crashed. So now we're back up to, good productivity. Everybody's 401ks are back up to speed. And those are 65-year-olds are now saying, okay, I'm out of here. I'm getting ready to leave. And boo on a lot of small companies. They didn't plan for this right. So they're struggling with finding that skilled workforce. Those are the people that are leaving and taking lots of talent with them. And we don't have a whole lot of people in the middle. So now we have to bring in a lot of young people. So the value of an apprenticeship or some very strong structured on-the-job training program is becoming much more aware in the minds of manufacturers today, because they don't have anybody in the middle. They really have to rely on Joe, who's going to retire, and hope that he's going to stick around long enough to train Susie, who's coming in off the street, who's never worked in a manufacturing plant. So it's a challenge. And apprenticeship is one of the potential answers, a good structured apprenticeship.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name's Pete Shutley. I'm retired from Brookings. My question is workforce development. When a major globally known manufacturing company moves to some of the southern, more rural states, I'm thinking of Mercedes going to Alabama, or BMW going to South Carolina, Boeing going to South Carolina. And so my question is, what do they do with the state to get that trained workforce? Do they say to the state, we will move there if you train this many people and have them available, or the schools should train this many people, and once you have them, we'll move there? Or what's the secret behind them getting a manufacturing-skilled workforce out of a formerly rural area?
It's a meeting of the minds. Many of those states are saying that before the company says it. The southern states, I will say, and I grew up in manufacturing states of the Midwest, have – more centralized systems. So when the state says, come here, we're going to figure it out, they can figure it out a lot faster because they have more, I don't want to use the word control, but the centralization of the education and the workforce system is there so that one person at the state level really can say, we're going to make this work no matter where you move in our state, because we can create some more seamless and similar programs across the state. And that is what it is. Let's face it, that's why companies move from one state to another, because there's some incentive on the table. Was there a bigger workforce already trained in South Carolina or Alabama? No. But the states were more interested in trying to make sure that that happened. Are they struggling? It's still a struggle.
For example, Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee, they have the Volkswagen, Academy. So they really train it. They have a big apprenticeship program. They're training their people because the state is not going to provide them. The state probably invests some money into it, but it's always teamwork. They have to work together. And yes, in Alabama, I don't think that they just found a workforce which is totally ready for it. On the other hand, also have to say, a lot of the jobs in automotive manufacturing can be trained because they're repetitive. Mm-hmm. We are a very small manufacturing. We are manufacturing custom-designed equipment. Mm-hmm. Well, what we build today, we may never build again, and what we did yesterday doesn't help us today, so we need a lot more skills. And yes, there is a lot of support companies around an automotive manufacturer, which also they need skills. But I don't think there is a state out there that just has all the skills available which are needed. I think it's the workforce even there. That's the first point, because you have to have enough people. If you have if you put up a Mercedes plant, you have to have a lot of people. But then you have to do training, and they start training way before they start production. Otherwise, they're not going to be ready.
I think we have time for one last question in the back.
Ken Jarva from NEA again. In all this discussion about getting students hands-on experience, nobody has mentioned the words maker movement. How does the maker movement fit into getting young people, A, excited about manufacturing, and B, get them the skills they need to then go into manufacturing?
I mean, I think you said it.
Yes.
You know, the maker movement is a huge impetus for manufacturing, and it's been a great, in many ways, kind of grassroots effort to have people have, you know, whether it's kind of a DIY home tinkerer or whether it's, you know, the high school shop teacher who suddenly has kind of a new way of talking about or seeing their work, the maker movement becomes a huge component of this work. So I'm so glad you brought it up. When we think about things like, you know, alternative educational models like a hackathon or a boot camp, something like, you know, the maker movement, you know, particularly the kind of research that's coming out of someplace like Indiana University, where they're particularly sort of supporting and talking about what those skills are, textbooks, all of those ways that the maker movement is also really being kind of codified, has I think made it a huge effort. And then also that you have something, you know, like a national magazine like Make, you know, that's coming out that gives people you know, kind of hands-on activities and a point of entry into this work is huge. And if people aren't familiar with the maker movement, if you haven't been to a maker fair, you know, that's my homework assignment to you, is to create one in your town or to go to a maker fair. They're fascinating. They're really inspiring and also interesting. There's a lot of, you know, research about how inclusive and, you know, some of the maker communities are, but I still think it's a great and really interesting and hopeful kind of, you know, homegrown effort that's really, you're really seeing also a lot of small companies, you know, whether it's Little Bits or, you know, Adafruit or, you know, other small companies that are also sort of building and taking the maker movement into interesting online spaces as well. So I think that's all the time we have. I want to thank our panelists for joining us today. And thank you.
Hi, Li Bin. Yeah, Li Bin. Yeah, Chinese Embassy.
Oh,
good morning, everyone. I think we'll go ahead and get started so that we can get out of here on time. I'm Doug Palmer. I cover international trade for Politico, and have been doing that for a number of years. And I'd like to thank Brookings, first of all, for asking me to moderate this event. I've actually covered a number of discussions in this room, but I've never seen it from up here, so it's kind of a novel experience for me. As everyone knows, there's been a lot of focus on manufacturing in the U.S. presidential election in terms of concerns over lost jobs and the U.S. ability to compete. Back in 1969, when I was 10 years old, there were about 18.4 million people who were employed in manufacturing in the United States. And in 1999, when I turned 40, there were still about 17.4 million manufacturers. But after the turn of the century, there was a steep drop in U.S. manufacturing jobs to about 12.3 million currently. I mean, there was a decline, and there's been a bit of a bounce lately. The U.S. share of world manufacturing has also fallen as China has taken over as the world's largest manufacturer. Still, there was just a recent report by Deloitte for the U.S. Council on Competitiveness, which ranked the United States as the world's second most competitive manufacturing country, just behind China. And that same report also projects the United States to be the most competitive manufacturing country by 2020. So we're honored today to have four distinguished speakers to discuss the role of governments in supporting manufacturing. Representative David Cicilline is a fourth-term congressman from Rhode Island, and his district, I found from doing a little reading, includes Slater Mill, which is known as the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution. I don't think they make many textiles in Rhode Island anymore, but I'm hoping the right. Well, anyway, I hope the congressman will inform us on the opportunities and challenges facing manufacturers in his district. Anthony Murfitt, next in line, there is a Minister Counselor for Industry, Science, and Education at the Australian Embassy here in Washington. Like the United States, Australia's manufacturing sector has experienced a number of changes over the past three decades, but still is an important element of the country's economy. Next down the line, we have Dong-Soo Kim. He is a research fellow at the Korean Institute for Industrial Economics, and he's here to give us a South Korean perspective on the issue. South Korea was ranked fifth in that Deloitte study I mentioned on global manufacturing competitiveness. It's the world's largest shipbuilder and the fifth largest automobile producer. And finally, on the end here, we have Li Bin, who is counselor for economic affairs at the Chinese embassy. China is the largest manufacturing of motor vehicles as well as toy products and has a rapidly expanding middle class that makes it a growing market for many American goods. But as we all know, China's rise as a manufacturer has made it a frequent target in U.S. political campaigns. So we're eager to hear Councillor Lee's views on where Chinese manufacturing is headed in the next decade. But Congressman, would you mind starting us off with a few thoughts about manufacturing? And
sure. Thank you for including me. I'm delighted to be here with the White family. You know, Rhode Island has a very long history of manufacturing, as you mentioned, the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution. And I really had an economy that was really built around manufacturing. And so I focused a lot of my efforts since I've been elected to Congress to what can we do to help support and grow our American manufacturing, fundamentally kind of recognizing that, in my view, in order for us to really have an economy that works, we have to make things in this country. And, in fact, if we have policies that create a level playing field, American manufacturers can compete like no one else. We make the best products in the world. We have the best workforce in the world. But what we have to do is have level playing field so we can actually compete in a global economy. And I think we have a number of policies in place that actually undermine our ability to promote American manufacturing. But I think one of the things I want to just mention early in this is I think this is a real opportunity for American manufacturing because this growth of the maker movement and the role of 3D printing and all the new technologies that make making things cool again, I think gives us an opportunity. I think, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years, if a child came home and said, "Mom, Dad, you know, I want to be a manufacturer," parents would have been like, "Really?" You know, with this idea of manufacturing being dirty and someone else is going to do it and it's a dying industry. And I think the maker movement has helped to change that people recognize that manufacturing jobs pay better on average than non-manufacturing jobs, that making things is cool again. And so it's informing the way we think about education, job training, career and vo-tech education. But I think, you know, people want to make things and everyone can now be a manufacturer. So part of kind of removing the stigma of manufacturing, which I think we were labored under for a long time, which was bad for our country and bad for our economy, has finally changed. And I think this is a very exciting time because as you look at kind of new and more advanced manufacturing that really focuses on the intersection of making things and design, America is a real leader in this. And this is where I think we have a huge opportunity, my home state in particular, but America in general, because of the kind of innovation and design and the new, more advanced manufacturing where I think we have a real leg up. And so I think this next century is going to be a century of great excitement and growth for American manufacturing.
Great. Thanks for those comments. Mr. Burford, would you mind going next?
So I thought I'd give just like a little bit of context to the Australian manufacturing sector and the Australian economy. And it does show some very a lot of similarities with the US. But firstly, I've got to be a little bit bureaucratic in that if you're watching Australian election cycle, we just had an election. The outcomes are unknown, so we're still operating what's called caretaker. So as part of my role, I've got to make sure delivering factual information. I can't do any commentary on government policy or what may come. But that aside, I'll now get on to a little bit of history about the Australian economy and manufacturing. So in October, barring any catastrophe, and I say that probably with a word of caution in the environment we're living at the moment, our Australian Bureau of Statistics will release a report highlighting that Australia's GDP, or its gross domestic product, will have its 25th year of consecutive growth. Now, that is, there's only one other country that's had a similar track, and that's the Netherlands, and that's been for 27 years, and the economy that's behind is actually Korea, who's had 18 years of consecutive growth. So a little bit about the size of our economy. It's not as big as the US economy, which is around just under 18 trillion in GDP for 2015. Australia has its economy in 2015 in US dollars was 1.22 trillion. That being said, it's still a significant global player, and I think we're around the 12th largest economy around the world. In the Australian system as well, we have a large proportion of small to medium enterprises, and importantly, if we compare it to the US, they're probably considered micro businesses. We have usually an account from 1 to 200, which is in the micro area in the US sense. Then turning to manufacturing itself. So, yeah, 30 years ago, I can confess I was born, and as part of that, there was one in six jobs were in manufacturing, and if we turn to today, there is now one in 13. And until 2005 and 6, manufacturing was the single largest sector in the Australian economy. Today, it is now the fifth largest industry, and it is behind things such as mining, financial services, construction, and health. And again, that's a story not dissimilar to what's happening here in the US. But to reinforce, though, it is the fifth largest, and it's still quite a very significant part of the Australian economy. It contributes $100 billion to gross value add. It has over 7% of employment. It contributes 6.2% to our GDP. And importantly, it undertakes around 25% of business research and development. So a little bit of the backstory of, you know, how has that sort of come about. And some of this may has been that, you know, we live in a global economy and there have been a lot of changes. We have disruptive technologies. We've seen this eastward shift in the global economic centre of gravity. We've seen increased globalisation and urbanisation and the rise of the Asian middle class. And that's created a greater demand on Australian resources, goods. And there's also been a greater request or demand on energy, food and water. And Australia being an open economy, it's also exposed to many of these conditions. And things that are also impacting on us is that technology is lowering the cost of entry. Competitive advantage is much more easily gained and also eroded. And businesses are starting up and failing much quicker. And interestingly, the composition of businesses themselves are changing, and there's now a different business capability that's required if we compare back to traditional industries probably before I was born. And then turning now to manufacturing, because that's the general sort of economic environment. Those that have followed Australia, you've probably seen that we've had some high-profile closures in our automotive industry and in our steel sector. Some of the reasons that have attributed to this have been around increasing labour costs and production costs. and until recently, a fastly appreciating dollar, and also things around increasing global competitors, particularly from low-cost countries. But it's not all doom and gloom. Through that period as well, there were parts of the manufacturing sector that were quite successful and showed resilience. And one of those was in the food and beverage sector, which contributed 20,000 jobs in Australia in the 10 years up to 2015. So what does manufacturing now mean in Australia? And I'm sure we'll explore that in the panel. And I think touching on some of the earlier comments, you know, manufacturing is transitioning from making a thing or a widget to the full suite of activity. So it really is now this design, it is the R&D, it is the development of the product, it is the creation of the product, but it's also the delivery, the logistics, and also the aftermarket service. So there is a full spectrum in which there are opportunities. One thing Australia is also having a look at doing is, well, we're looking at things through the lens of competitiveness. Yeah, how can we be competitive? Where are our competitive advantages and where are our comparative advantages? And what we've seen is that particularly in our areas of advanced manufacturing, these high-skilled and medium-skilled advanced manufacturers are really forging new markets. And that's recognised in some of our export figures that have seen that the exports of manufacturing has grown recently. So I'll sort of just conclude in the Australian environment thinking, you know, around the world, what are we seeing and what does the future bring? Well, if I had a crystal ball, you know, I probably wouldn't be sitting here, I'd be doing other things. But I think some of the themes that have sort of come out when we've looked at these particular issues, it's working out where are we competitive and how can we compete. It's embracing change and embracing the technology that is coming about. It's looking at things like the makers movement and how do we make manufacturing really exciting. Collaboration and innovation are a really important part. I think as we come across multiple issues, no one country can do one thing and no one manufacturer can do one thing. So it's important to engage with R&D. And, of course, you know, we need to keep an eye on and embrace trade.
Great. Thanks very much. Mr. Kim, what's the view from South Korea?
Well, South Korea is pretty well known for the manufacturing industry these days, and many people from the developing country, they are just visiting us to benchmark Korean manufacturing rapid development history. Sometimes I was very confused because really Korean manufacturing industry is really mature to share our experience to the developing countries or not. It was pretty fantastic from for the outsiders, but insiders like Korean experts like me, we smell some kind of crisis. We see kind of big waves. Even though prosperous performance in the IT industries, still our traditional main manufacturing industries are like shipbuilding, automobile, and steel, and petrochemicals, and petro refineries, and et cetera, et cetera. In the very short term, we are struggling to, we have a really strong pressure to restructure our, those traditional industrial sectors because of the overcapacity problem. But more mid-term or longer-term view, actually, we need to find out the new growth engine, such as like ICT sectors or semiconductor convergence of those two, even sometimes convergence with service sectors, etc. We caught up very fast. But now we are not follower anymore in some specific sectors, then we don't know where to go and we don't know how to go further sometimes. That's a big problem in more longer term. And it was very, it is very a good opportunity to me to join this forum this morning, actually. Because I could remind myself about the more fundamental issues in manufacturing industry, which means like a misconception or for the manufacturing industry in Korea, that's a huge. I don't know how can adjust, how can correct. Yeah, as you discussed, that's like 3D sectors in Korea right now. The best college student doesn't go to the manufacturing area at all. They go to the medical school. They go to the law school rather than engineering school. And in the first discussion session, I think Jennifer talked about the STEM cell, STEM education. That's pretty important for the manufacturing economy. But unfortunately, Korean youth, Korean young people, they are very risk averse at this time. So that is more fundamental, longer-term problem in Korea. And we need to figure it out, how to attract the youth people to engage and participate in the manufacturing industry. That's the current issues in Korea.
Thanks very much. Councilor Lee.
I think the Chinese manufacturing, of course, is really a very large sector, not only in China but also in the world, because it not only it employs a lot of people, but also contributes a lot of GDP and also a lot of export to the rest of the world. The manufacturing in China, I think, can be divided into foreign and non-foreign ones. I mean, domestic and international foreign ones, which means when foreign enterprises invest in China, that is one sector or foreign sector. Manufacturing sector, mostly solely foreign-owned, joint ventures, and that, so there is a special feature for that because, you know, mostly we want to learn from foreign countries' technologies and also ways of doing things and practices. So, and also many of the products are really targeted for export markets. And there are, and the other sector is really our pure domestic manufacturing, which has nothing to do with foreign investment. And that has also its own special characteristics, which means we have to rely on ourselves, right? Because we do the R&D by ourselves. And we can export, and we don't have to export. And that differs from one case to another. And so mostly, I think, foreign invested manufacturing sector, I think it's really very advanced because we have, you know, introduced foreign technologies, and also the orders are from foreign companies also sometimes, and because they must suit the needs of the foreign users or consumers. Usually the quality is very good, and also the price is pretty competitive. So I think several features of China's manufacturing can be summarized as below. First of all, the scale is very large, as I said. Secondly, the quality of the products mostly is pretty good, if, especially if they're foreign. But the issue, the problem is, I mean, the value added is not very high. Mostly, the Chinese manufacturers only get small share of money or income. Well, the foreign users or the foreign consumers or foreign dealers will get more than what the Chinese manufacturers have got. For example, maybe for one product, they can get only $1 or $5 or $10. But if it is resold in foreign markets, it can be resold for $50 or $100, whatever, right? For example, I mean, the most obvious case is iPhone, you know, manufactured in China with a capacity. Usually factories like Foxconn can be 300,000 or 400,000 workers, which is the largest factory in the world just for this single factory, not to mention the total capacity of manufacturing for China. something that you seldom see in other parts of the world. But actually, really, the Chinese manufacturers, they don't get so much. And that's very important characteristics. Second one is that the R&D content or design content, or you know, is very small because mostly it's foreign technologies. And so mostly we just manufacture, we just produce, we just do the manufacture. So, you know, it's not designed by China, it's not designed by ourselves. It's not innovation or invention by the Chinese manufacturers. So a very famous article in the Time magazine, the covers article, is they said, why not China innovate or invent, something like that, right? So that's a very obvious problem for the Chinese manufacturers. And thirdly, of course, I think the quality of the people in this sector still not very high, needs to be improved. Workers, of course, they need to improve because they are not college educated or even master's degree. Mostly they are workers, right? So not very high standard of education, which means that they need to improve. And so the government needs to provide more money to this to those enterprises, especially small and medium ones, because the large enterprises are pretty powerful in terms of money for training. So this is, you know, concerning human resources. And also I think the fourth problem of Chinese manufacturing is sometimes the products are still not meeting with the demand because they still follow suits. What others have done, and then they just copy, or you know, rather than really figure out what the customers really need, no matter the customer is in China or in other countries. Because today is the biggest task or challenge for our manufacturing, you know, is still to provide the best services or products. But if you don't sit down and spend many years in doing R&D and thinking or, you know, studying, rather than just want to get quick results or quick profits or, you know, just relying on foreign technologies, manufacturing will go to nowhere. So I think there are still some other features or disadvantages or shortcomings for manufacturing, but those are just a few examples. Concerning future plan for our manufacturing in China, I think our country has already announced a plan for 2025. Which is only 9 years away, which is very short. I think the plan is very clear that by 2025, and China will reach a certain level, and then by 2035, another level, and by 2049, when the People's Republic is 100 years old, another level, which means that at the final stage, China will become a developed, important manufacturing state. But in 2035, we can only something in between. I mean, between the 2050 and something which is 2025, which means that we can manufacturing and we can increase our own R&D capability. We can do some designs and innovations, but still not enough. So those are the three stages for 2025, which is really to learn the experience or the content of Industry 4.0, and also similar things in the United States and Japan. And so we think the ambition in that document, of course, is very grand, but the issue is how to implement it. Especially, I think the most important thing for a successful realization of that plan is really education and also innovation, invention. Especially to rely on ourselves for R&D activities and rather than just solely, you know, have something coming in and then do it, manufacture it in China. That period and era has passed. If we don't finish that and we still rely on that during the past during the next 10 years or 25 years, manufacturing cannot be improved. And so that needs
some thinking, especially for enterprises, because enterprises are the backbone and the engine of manufacturing growth in China. Government can only provide some services and good policies and strategies, but the backbone, the major players are still enterprises, because government only provide a platform like this one, right? And then the players, like five of us, we are the enterprises, and we should do the R&D, invention, innovation, and you know, labs, experiments, things like that. And that's the most important thing. And the other point that I just missed is the international competitiveness of the Chinese products that I didn't mention. And the international, the Chinese enterprises going international still needs to be improved, because maybe they are pretty competitive domestically, but when they go to international scenes, there are few enterprises which can provide very good brands, makings or makes, or, you know, which are as famous as, you know, other brands, like, you know, international brands, American brands, Japanese brands, Italian brands. So we have so few international brands that many people only know that we are the largest manufacturing country in the world, but they don't know which are those famous brands. Maybe the issue is there's no brands, or maybe there are few brands, or there are small brands, or at least maybe publicity is not doing enough, so people don't know what your famous brands are. Right. So without those brands, how can you be a strong, refined, famous international reputation manufacturing country? You can only be a manufacturing country, maybe large, big, but it's not good enough, because it needs to be very detailed, very refined, very everything, you know, very small things, very, you must do a good job, not just the big one, small things, very important. And that is the very area I think Chinese manufacturers needs to be improved. And it is we are far from yet to be satisfied with our manufacturing, but rather we should feel that we should use a mirror and then see ourselves in this mirror and say that there's many areas that we need to improve, and we must have a sense of crisis during the next, not 10 years or 20 years, which will come very quickly. And if we want to succeed in this sector, enterprises, government, universities, and research institutions must have a sense of urgency, and also we should do a good job in respecting IPRs of foreign countries, because without IPRs, without the respect for IPRs, nobody will manufacture, because if you manufacture, it will be copied by someone else, and then people will have no incentive to manufacture, and that is also very important for a successful manufacturer. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Those are very interesting comments. I mean, everybody does sort of think of China as the manufacturing heavyweight, but you're sort of describing it as a work in progress, that there's still areas that China needs to work on as it goes forward. Congressman, one of the things that I noticed you saying was that you thought that some of the policies that the U.S. have actually undermines our efforts to promote manufacturing in the United States. Could you talk a little bit more about that, where you see the deficiencies, and maybe where you see stuff that the government is doing well?
Sure. I think the principal place that our policies undermine American manufacturing is our tax code. We tend to provide better treatment very often in terms of the treatment of revenue or income to companies that have manufacturing operations outside of the United States. And so you incentivize American companies to actually produce products outside the United States, because under the tax code they can assign the profits to that company outside of the United States. And so companies that do all of their manufacturing in the United States that don't have that same external operation can't do that. And so you've created an economic disincentive to keep jobs in America and an economic incentive to create manufacturing jobs outside the United States, which is counterintuitive. So I think there are things within the tax code, the research and development tax credit, to make those more generous and permanent, so that we can encourage the kind of R&D that the council just spoke about that are so critical to 21st century manufacturing. And so I think, you know, our tax code principally is a place we could enact a set of new policies that really understand this new economy. I think the area that we have done okay on, but is probably the biggest challenge for American manufacturers, is workforce training and workforce development. I know the last panelist mentioned the Deloitte study, which said, you know, there will be about 3.5 million manufacturing jobs over the next decade. 2 million of them may go unfilled, and that is in large part because of not having people with the skills necessary to fill those jobs. I mean, every time I visit a manufacturing facility in my state, I am told by the owners of the company, we have jobs today, which we just can't fill because we can't find people with the skills necessary to fill those jobs. It used to be the case, of course, that you could graduate from high school and go to the manufacturing where your mother and father worked and get a job and a good-paying job and support your family. That is not the case anymore. It doesn't require a four-year college education, but it almost always requires some advanced training, some post-secondary education. And so having really good alignment between what, you know, manufacturers need, what the private sector is demanding in terms of skills. I mean, for a long time, these workforce training programs were just sort of independently deciding what they wanted to train people for. And then someone thought, oh, well, how about talking to actually people who are going to hire them and find out what skills they actually need and then aligning that training? I think that's happening much more now. But we really have to continue this effort in STEAM education. We changed it from STEM to STEAM because that art piece is really important. This art and design component of, you know, the STEAM education is a big part of it. So just to anticipate the problem the council mentioned, we've got to be very focused on understanding the value of art and design and innovation in this new kind of manufacturing. So I think we should stay focused very much on workforce development. We should reform our tax code and at least create a level playing field. And then finally, I know we'll talk about this later, we have to have trade agreements that don't create a real disadvantage for American manufacturers.
Okay, thanks very much. Just from the comments made up here and some of the previous comments from the other panels, I am sort of struck by this idea that the hard time that manufacturers have recruiting young workers to come in and work in their factories. And I just wondered, is that a problem that is common throughout all countries? I mean, do you see that in China? Is it difficult to attract young workers into manufacturing jobs? What are they doing in China to sort of overcome that?
Of course, one issue that I failed to mention just now is the rising cost of the Chinese workers. That's one issue, because many of the workers have gone back to their countryside. And because, as we know, that there are about 250 million so-called farm laborers working in the urban area. But they are not necessarily all working in the manufacturing, but I can say that many of them were working in the manufacturing. So the issue of the labor issue, as you mentioned, is on the one hand rising cost, but also sometimes it is very hard to acquire or get workers because maybe there's not enough. Not to mention about some of the quality of some of the workers are not high enough because they are not meeting the demands of the employers. The employers do need more or need better employees, but they just cannot get. And as you mentioned, in many of the factories in the coastal area, the employers feel very bad because they just cannot get enough good and better qualified workers. And the other day I went to a ceremony where a factory company from China in the robotics, artificial intelligence, you know, they give a speech. And one thing that surprised me is that sometimes the employers use robots not just for the consideration of saying robotics can save some money or their salary, if they have a salary, it's not as high as the people's salary, but rather they cannot get the workers, so they have to utilize the robotics. So that really surprised me because I thought, oh, they use you know, machines in order to replace people, because machines can be more effective, more efficient, and then so that they can earn money and save the cost. But actually, I was wrong. But not, I was not, maybe I was, you know, there was also some circumstances, but at least that was one circumstances. So that is why I think the other scenario which excites me is that maybe by the end of the year, I think the new babies born in China will be increased, because the policy was to allow the second baby to be born among the couple, although in the previous year or the previous year, only one baby, because the government has realized that there is a lack of babies, which is the future would-be laborers in the market. Mm-hmm. So we should see the figure by the end of the year as to how many babies will be born, because the euro situation will be 16 million, 16. And then each year, 8 million Chinese people died. So the newly net increase of the new population is about another 8 million. And so some people say that in maybe 20, 30, or 40, and then the Chinese population will be something like 600 million, which I don't believe, which I don't also want to admit, because that is too far away. You cannot predict for that period of time. But at least at the current stage, maybe given that policy, and then the population will be increased. By how much? Nobody knows. We should look at it by the end of the year.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Mr. Kim, my pet topic is trade. That's what I've written about for too long. I know that South Korea has a number of free trade agreements with the United States, with the European Union, a long list of others. Do you think that has been beneficial? Has that helped boost the manufacturing sector in South Korea?
I think absolutely that's true. That's true. But free trade agreement in a short term period, that's pretty beneficial to us, uh-huh. to our manufacturing industry. But I think theoretically, if all countries just make an agreement, then our benefit will be disappeared, right? That, in that sense, free trade agreement, maybe just we can just take some kind of advantage in the short term. But instead of think about that, we focus more on the political side. For example, we are trying to join the RCEP or TPP, which one might be better. We cannot decide the only economic way. We need to think about the political relationship between Korea and China, Korea and United States. We are just in the middle of two big giant G2 countries. So that's another issue. That's, I think, much more important than simply economic free trade agreement.
Just the geopolitical alliances or balancing?
How can I say? Politically, we are close to the United States. Absolutely, we are just a market economy, democratic country. But economically, the total trade volume with China is about 25% of entire trade of Korea. Absolutely, China is the number one. The largest market to the Korean manufacturing industry. So we need to pay attention, absolutely. But sometimes there might be some kind of conflict, not economic conflict, but political conflict. So it is really difficult to balancing in between. That's the sort of current problem.
One thing that I find interesting is a comparison between the Korea's manufacturing and also the Chinese one. I recently find that, like Samsung, its competitiveness has been reduced in China and the world, compared with Apple company and maybe some other companies. I think it's especially their manufacturing or performances in China is decreased. I think maybe given the change of, you know, leaders, in the company or whatever reason, which something that we only speak in this room, not outside, or some other reasons, because we see more and more people utilizing Apple, few and few utilizing Samsung, which is something that worries me because Samsung, in my mind, was a good company. My friend worked there, and we used to deal with the company. But I know that a good company, for a good company to become a bad company, or, you know, it's very quick. Nortel, whatever, right? Lucent, whatever. So I think all famous international top companies face this challenge. If you don't R&D, if you don't stabilize, if you don't do a good job, and then you retreat, and then you go back to the maybe, you know, second tier, third tier. For GE company, if one unit is second tier, they sell it. So in this world, there's no meaning to maintain second tier companies. You just sell it because you only maintain the first tier.
Mr. Murphy, do you have any thoughts on the role of trade agreements in advancing manufacturing in Australia? Has that had an impact one way or another?
Well, I think if you you look at our history, we've embraced the approach. We started with New Zealand, our closest neighbour, went to Singapore, and we have a trade agreement with the US, and obviously a large part of the TPP. I think the benefits are there. It's this a common rule of law, so there is a consistent and level playing field. And some of the things we're finding also in with our manufacturers, it's increasing competition, which means they're finding new solutions and new products and new competitive advantages. And as a result of some of the tariff reductions that have come in, it means that there are lower cost inputs, which means we can focus on the quality of our products and then forge new export markets. So I think it's been quite positive for our manufacturers.
See, we're kind of getting close to the end of time, so I should turn to the audience. This gentleman right here in the blue cap has his hand up.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. I'm Elliot Hurwitz, former State Department official, former World Bank contractor, Intelligence Committee member. Minister Pin, you mentioned the enterprise as the core of the Chinese manufacturing sector, I think, didn't you? I think the government plays a larger role in the manufacturing sector in China than the enterprises do. So I would appreciate your answer on this.
Yeah, you are right. Government in China plays a very important part in every sphere, not only economic development, but also in support of China's manufacturing. And I think that can be done through, you know, many ways, traditional ways and new ways. I mean, for example, you know, rebate, tax reduction, tax exemption, giving very cheap land to foreigners or whatever, or maybe domestic manufacturers, because if that land is utilized in some alternative way, that can be very expensive. For example, building dormitories or whatever, apartments for people. But if it is used for joint ventures, very, say, advanced manufacturing or whatever, it can be free, right? I mean, at least this was true in the past. So you can see a comparative cost of land for different purposes, which is another interesting topic that you can write a dissertation on. And so what I said is that enterprises should play a very important role in the future innovation or invention, which means they're not doing that enough because mostly they get support from the government, either it's fiscal or financial. So that is not enough. And that will not create or lead to very good enterprises and famous international brands. So my point is that in the future, government should do more on R&D, on design in China, not just manufacturing in China. And government should do what is deemed as appropriate rather than doing so many things. Because if you are replacing enterprises or acting as enterprises to do things, that is not correct. That is not the word government, but you know, something else. So government should try to find its own position for supporting enterprises to behave, and also enterprises of different natures, private, foreign, and state, should be treated equally, which is not enough done at the current stage. That is also another challenge for the Chinese manufacturers. So I think what I said is really the same as you have mentioned, which is to say in the past, government really did a lot of things to support manufacturers, but enterprises did not do enough, which means that in the future, enterprises should do more, and government should make what they do more reasonable than before.
Okay, Congressman?
Yeah, I just want I think this is one of the fundamental differences between, in general, American manufacturing and Chinese manufacturing. The notion that the government would be more active in the design work is not how I think our economy works. We want to promote the development of entrepreneurship and design and innovation, obviously, in the private sector, and we need to fund research and development. But I think the real strength that the American manufacturing economy has, and I think, frankly, is the big challenge in China, is a sophisticated level of a legal system that protects intellectual property. You are not going to create an environment in which entrepreneurs and designers and innovators are going to create products without some confidence that they can retain it and that someone can't walk over the next day, steal it, and use it. And, you know, sort of what's, there's no incentive. Not only culturally do you have to create an environment where people feel excited about inventing and designing new things because they have ownership of it, but to protect it from being stolen by others. And I think, you know, the role of the Chinese government could be much more productive if it played a real role in helping to create a much stronger system for protecting intellectual property, because I think it would make it a more attractive trading partner and a more, it would be more beneficial to the long-term growth of manufacturing in China. This is something I think that the United States has tremendous advantage in virtually every other country. We have a real system here designed to protect intellectual property. It's not perfect. We have lots of work to do in it, but it's a real value. And I just think that you mentioned that earlier in your comment, kind of the role of the government. I think this notion of the protection of intellectual property has very serious long-term consequences if it's not addressed.
Another point that Congressman's view, asked me to, you know, think about one more thing, which is the U.S. enterprises going back to the United States. Of course, I mean, the president has the policy to attract them to go back to United States, because in the past, the energy cost was low, right? So it was an incentive. But if that is the issue, that's okay. But if there are some other factors in that coming back of enterprises of U.S. back to the United States soil, I think if it is because of, you know, they don't think the policies are not transparent, they don't think the investment climate is not that satisfactory, if they don't think if they think the cost in China is also going higher, if they think sometimes the policies or strategies are not that clear, and that is something else. So these two must be clarified. If it is because of the former, which is going back and because of the energy cheap price, and then so that the final price will be cheaper, and that's understandable, right? But if it is because of the other things, which is the latter, and then that means certain government, they need to improve their work so that investment climate should be improved. And then maybe, even if you have policies to attract them to go back, they will not go back. They will still stay there. Otherwise, they can go to some other countries like Vietnam or even Bangladesh, if the policy is good or the services are good. But maybe you don't think what I said is related to what you are concerned. But I don't know why this suddenly came into my mind, and I just want to talk about this because the subject is not this, but it's related.
Yeah, yeah, it is related.
No, it's an interesting point. There was a young lady in the very back of the room who wanted to ask a question. Right there.
Hi, I'm Crystal Liu, and I'm a student from Vanderbilt University. And thank you for Councillor Lee for sharing the information about China. And for the past decade, we've seen great improvements in China in terms of business development and manufacturing. So President Xi have encouraged the millennials to to do entrepreneurial work. And also we've seen big electronic companies such as Huawei and Xiaomi successfully premiered on the world stage. But as Councillor Li mentioned, in order for China to reach its 2025 manufacturing goal, there's still a long way, especially in terms of how to encourage young people to do more innovative work. So I was just wondering, for the last panel, and also Congressman Sicilian also mentioned, there are a lot of initiatives that are taking place in the United States, such as the apprentice program. So I'm just curious, is there any specific initiatives sponsored by the government that are taking place in China? And also my second question is, I was going to ask something about intellectual property rights, but since you just covered that. So I'm just thinking, 2 weeks ago, I went to the Wilson Center, and there was a lecture on its China store closing. And we've heard a substantial amount of concern from U.S. business in terms of the ambiguities of Chinese policies. So do you think the Chinese government is going to make some clear statements to attract more foreign companies, or do you think this is not something that is on the agenda of the Chinese government?
The second question. Second question, I will answer first because otherwise I will forget. I really don't know the specific case that you mentioned, but basically, I think I don't think there is any change of policy for Chinese leaders to attract foreign investment, right? Because But certainly, if the policies, as I said, are not clear, are not transparent, and can give you a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity, of course, foreigners or foreign companies will feel very bad or hesitated from investing more or increase their investment in China. So I think this is something that the government, of course, should pay attention to and should try to make every enterprise happier, not only foreign ones, but also domestic, not only state-owned, but also private enterprises. And for the first question, otherwise I will forget, about young people, innovation, very interesting topic, because I see hope in you, because you are the future, you are the hope of the world's future and maybe China's future. And I think Premier Li Keqiang has attached great importance to this so-called double innovation, right? To have all people or many people start an enterprise and to have, you know, some of the elites to innovate, because only the elites can innovate. Well, the majority can start an enterprise, because I can start an enterprise, but I'm not an elite. I cannot innovate. So I think government has policies, of course. If you read them on the internet and also some internal documents, of course there are policies. But the innovation is not only to attract young people to innovate, but also some of the age groups, although the young people are the very dominant, because we know that physically or, you know, young people are very suited for innovation, because if they are in their 20s, 25 or 30s, but if you are too old like me, I mean 70s or 60s, and then you cannot innovate so much. I think there are many policies, strategies, incentives, in terms of, you know, taxes and other, even banking loans. And also I heard when I was in Beijing in the previous time, I heard also many people, if they have an idea, and then somebody will give them money, because when they see your CV, they think you are the potential, that you are capable of doing the innovation, and then they will give you the money. So now I think in China, the atmosphere is very good, and the money is available, the policy is there, and the issue is how can those young people improve themselves so that they can have some good ideas, so that they can change those ideas into productive forces, which is a good product or a good service. So I think I'm really hopeful that not only people in China, but also people elsewhere in the world can innovate and also can, you know, design or manufacture some good products like we have, like the iPhones.
Can I just add just 2 points on that? It's okay. Just that, yeah, when particularly around skills, I think, and these were touched earlier, but it's really important to inspire the next generation to come through and engage in manufacturing and see how cool it is, which is why makers movement is important. And I think the other part is you also need to make sure the skills match your future need, which is why that then looping back with who is providing training meets the industry needs and where it's going. I think they're two parts in any policy design that probably really needs to come through.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. I think we could probably go another half hour or so, but unfortunately it's 12 o'clock and we've come to the end of our time. And I'd like to thank all of our panelists for participating today.